here. The stage is in darkness and clear. We're raising the curtain, and no one's quite certain who's played it. If we'd known just how right we were going to be. For we dreamed a lot, and we schemed a lot, and we tried to sing of love before the stage fell apart.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, January 13, 2020. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the right-hand side of our website. Tonight's scripture reading is in the Gospel of Mark. We're going to pick up where we left off last time. It was in chapter 9. Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, verses 1 through 13. And he, Jesus, said unto them, Truly I say unto you, that there be some of them that stand here which shall not taste of death till they have seen the kingdom of God come with power. And after 6 days Jesus taketh with him Peter, James, and John, and leadeth them up into a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his raiment became shining, exceedingly white as snow, so as no fuller on earth can white them. And there appeared unto them Elias and Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter answered and said to Jesus, Master, it is good for us to be here, and let us make three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elias. For he wist not what to say, for they were sore afraid. And there was a cloud that overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, saying, This is my beloved Son, hear him. And suddenly, when they had looked round about, they saw no man any more save Jesus, only with themselves. And as they came down from the mountain, he charged them that they should tell no man what things that they had seen, till the Son of Man were risen from the dead. And they kept that saying with themselves, questioning one with another what the rising from the dead should mean. And they asked him, saying, Why say the scribes that Elias must first come? And he, Jesus, answered and told them, Elias verily cometh first, and restoreth all things, and how it is written of the Son of Man that he must suffer many things, and be set at naught. But I say unto you that Elias is indeed come, and they have done unto him whatsoever they had listed, as it was written of him. Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, verses 1 through 13. Okay, a lot of things going on. We had quite a few papers we're going to be writing and putting out soon. We're working on something. We're planning something with the IRS. We did send out a call to people who want to join into that IRS, and some people had responded with some information and so on and so forth. what we need, though, is affidavits. So anybody who would like, who's got an IRS problem, whether they're being constantly bombarded with their paperwork, making some ridiculous claims or some ridiculous amounts of money, or if you're in court or heading to court in the IRS, you might want to put your affidavit in with our papers that we're going to be filing with the United States Supreme Court. We'll be filing them up on the Northern District here in New York. That's where they'll be filed, but they'll be served onto the United States Supreme Court, as we've been serving all of our papers. basically what we're looking for them is to do two things, okay? We're looking for them to send writs of mandamuses down to the federal district courts, commanding them to be obedient to the Constitution, because clearly they are not. We got quite a few judges that we have already indicted, and we're going to be pursuing quite a few more very shortly. We are moving quite a few cases over into our case at this point in time. That's starting to come up. Some cases are starting to mature, and we'll be going into decisions and orders. I think we got three or four of them that are ready for that. As I mentioned, I think a couple of weeks ago, we also have Second Amendment case here in New York State. We have moved into the federal court on the Northern District, you know, a court of record that we've opened, they have defaulted, and we'll be working on paperwork on that very shortly, hopefully this week. But there's so many other things going on, so not sure which is going to take precedence over which. Anybody going back to the IRS case, anybody who would like to join us on this IRS cases, go up to nationallibertyalliance.org, come down, go to Abusive Courts, click on Abusive Courts, and as you read down here, you'll see that you need to click on to the bottom to click here to fill out the form for joinder. Now, on that joinder form, you will see for IRS cases, it says IRS cases only, click IRS affidavit and follow the instructions. All other cases, just go and follow the instructions on the page. But the IRS case is a little different. What we want is affidavits. Now, there are two affidavit forms there. They both say the same thing, but one's in PDF and the other is in Word doc. So you can open both of them if you want to use the Word doc, or maybe you have some other kind of writing program and you need to cut and paste maybe out of the PDF. But you follow the criteria that is laid out in there. There's a form, and there are certain things that you need to address, and we list those things. We'd like to keep all affidavits short. I'd like to keep them down to about 2 pages max. 1 page is even better, but you do have to cover all of the facts, just the facts. No lore, not getting into anything, here or there, colorful, just the facts. And we lay out certain facts that you're going to want to address in the instructions there for that affidavit. So again, anyone that wants to do that, that's where you can go. And by the way, Chuck, maybe you might want to get into the queue, because I think we're going to be calling you, I guess, to make an announcement. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about the same subject matter that you'll be talking about after you do it. *6 to get into the queue. Let's see what else we got going here. So we have the IRS case. We have the New York case, the gun case, Second Amendment. And we have numerous other cases. There was something else, and I forget what it was, another case that we're going to be working on and filing, but I don't recall what that was. But I'll bring it up eventually. Let's see what we got here. Anything else here? Some notes. Okay, the subject matter we're going to be talking about is really the Second Amendment and the problems down in Virginia. I thought they had corrected themselves, but apparently things have gone and continued. But we'll see where we're at with that in a minute. Jen, before we talk about this any further, do we have any questions?
We have a whole bunch of questions tonight, John. Do you want to save them for after this?
Okay. Well, maybe we should do the questions first, because after we finish with Chuck and I have to say what I have to say, maybe that'll be the conversation for most of the night, hopefully. But let's go through some questions. If it gets too long, we'll save some for later on.
Okay. A couple brief announcements before that.
Go
okay.
Ahead. Yep.
We're still looking for some of the group leaders for the committee men. I'm looking for Region 1, which is Washington and Oregon. Region 5, which is North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Minnesota. Region 8, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia. Region 6, which is Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, and Iowa. 7 is Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. And possibly Area 4, which would be Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. So those areas we still are hopeful to come up with somebody to volunteer here. It would be great if you have, John mentioned he's going to write a position description, so we'll have a much better idea what your duties will be. So if you're interested, just email me at chan@nationallibertyalliance.org, and we'll go from there. I guess most of these other things we can kind of skip over and go to the first question. Can an inactive member of the National Guard, or one simply between duty assignments, serve in his local militia should the need arise? Also, if the guardsman's local militia were mustered while he was at home, would it be inappropriate for him not to serve alongside his neighbors? It's an appropriate question.
Okay. I see Brent is here. I think he'd be more qualified to answer that question. Brent, you want to hit *6? Because I see you came in as a host, so you should be able to hit *6 to unmute. *6 to mute yourself back. Do you want to handle that question, Brent?
You want me to read it again, Brent?
He's still muted. I'll try. Yep, he got himself unmuted. Go ahead, Brent. Did you get that question? You're unmuted, Brent. You should be able to speak unless you got muted on your computer side. Brent?
Excuse me.
Well, Brent's trying to fix that problem. Maybe we could take the next question, and we'll come back to that one.
Okay. I was curious about a jury nullification strategy. This person apparently wants to get on a jury and try nullification. So his thought would be to keep his mouth shut about being a constitutionalist, avoid getting culled or pruned before the trial. But when push comes to shove after the trial and you tell the magistrate that thinks he's a judge to do his job, what would be the best action here? The judge might get offended and try to punish you, I assume. You need a defense and an offensive strategy set for this point. I've heard of jurors getting prison time for this type of thing. Contempt, maybe? Thanks.
Well, yeah, there are some problems, there are some concerns that you have to be careful of. I don't think I'd worry too much about it if, you know, you're in the jury and you're speaking privately with other jurists. I would not speak in front of a prosecutor concerning these things, and I wouldn't speak in front of a judge. I wouldn't bring it up to them. I wouldn't talk to them about it. But I surely would, educate the other jurist with the knowledge that I might have concerning how the process works and how jury and what jury nullification is all about. When they make their decisions, it's supposed to be done in secret. The prosecutor, there's supposed to be nobody in the room except the jurist when they're negotiating out, the case, and they're trying to decide, innocent and guilt. So in that process, I definitely would share my knowledge. I would have probably a constitution in my back pocket to begin with, and I might have a couple of, note or two in there, probably a couple of things on jury nullification, and in order to educate the others. So that's what I would do. But definitely I wouldn't speak of it in front of the judge or the prosecutor. Wouldn't make any argument, make any claims or anything with any of those people, because that could be problematic. All right. But after that.
Okay. When organizing the people's well-regulated state militia, do government employees need to be excluded?
I would imagine absolutely that they would. But again, I'll let Brent handle that one. Brent, are you able to get your mic going yet? He's unmuted on this side. I can see that, but we're not hearing him if he's speaking. Maybe I don't know if he's coming in on a phone. Maybe you're muted on your phone side.
Let me try and mute him and unmute him and see. No, we can't mute him. No, there we go. No, let's unmute him.
You're unmuted, Brent.
Speak some words.
Right. Again, we'll wait till hopefully fixes that problem. Again, going back to, I don't believe that they can, but I don't have enough knowledge of that. I'm just going through the militia studies myself at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have those answers for sure.
Okay. Next question. Basically, I would like to know more on filing federal case against code enforcement for harassing me and giving me tickets. I see no course content. Apparently, this person had expected to find something under our free courses on it.
We do have some information on challenging jurisdiction, moving it to federal court, or even moving it into our case, in either case for cause. And you'll find that on our page. If you go to Abuse of Court, you will find it there. And you'll also find it under Education, where you'll see Court Forms, Process, and Instructions. Now, I think to get to that page, you have to be a premium member. A premium member is someone giving $5 a month or more. That's $60 a year. So You know, you give up a cup of coffee and a donut or a bagel or something once a month, and there's your $5 a month. So I'm sure everybody could afford that. But we have information on that page, court forms, process, and instructions. But I want to tell you something. If you don't have the experience in the court, you better be very careful. If you don't have the experience and the education of the process and how things work and being very careful.
Hello.
Yeah, there you go. You got it, Brent. Give us a minute, and I'll give you the mic in a second.
Got it fixed.
Okay, so anyway, you know, again, people want to proceed with caution here. Anybody that thinks that they can kind of just pick up some forms, go into a court, fill out the forms, I mean, you might get the form right, but now you got to defend it. And you got to understand where you're going. And believe me, you're going to get resistance, and you need to understand how to deal with the resistance. You have to have the right responses. You know, the other thing is you don't want to speak too much in the court. You have all you say, you put it on paper. That's where you want to put all your information. You can object to things, and then you can always let the judge know, I'm going to respond with my objection in writing. That's always the best way. It gives you time to think, put your thoughts together, put it on paper, think about it some more, clarify it, clean it up, and whatever, and then submit it. So that's one way to go. But you should have an appreciation on what may be coming up in the court, and you should have some material written up that you can respond to, quoting, you know, particular court cases or whatever it is, any kind of a code or regulation or statute that might control the court or the judge, the rules to some degree. Those rules don't apply to us, but we can apply those rules to the judge. To some degree, but again, if we're in a court of record, and that's where we all want to be, and it's a court of record, the judge doesn't even belong in the courtroom. There is no summary judgments. They're not to make any decisions. It's the tribunal that makes the decisions, and it is, the tribunal that makes the decisions. So again, proceed with caution. All right, Brent, you want to try to respond to those questions? We can repeat them about the militia.
Would you like me to repeat them, Brent? Or did he mute out on his phone again?
I don't know. He's unmuted on this side.
Right.
Brent, whatever you did to unmute yourself before, you want to do that again?
Speak again, Brent.
All right, we'll take our next question. Let Brent pipe in when he gets
it. Okay. This one is, how can I settle a warrant for my arrest? The file said I missed the court day, and after viewing it, I see they sent it to the wrong address, so I never received it.
Well, if you got proof of that, take that proof, go down to the court, submit it. They're probably going to try to arrest you, but I would presume that they would see your point and not arrest you. I would hope that they would do it. But look, there's nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action. And these courts are ignorant, and they do a lot of action. The other thing in a case, if you're concerned, and we don't know what kind of case this is, so I presume maybe a traffic case or something, but I don't know. If you're really, really concerned, you might want to have a lawyer go to take care of it for you. I don't know what they would charge you for that. I can't believe they charge you too much, $500, $200, I don't know. But that's if you're really concerned that they may arrest you. All right, Brent, any luck with your mic yet?
What I'm working with him on Skype. He'll be back in a minute.
All right, whatever he did before worked. So, okay, next question. Jan, you got to unmute yourself. Jan, did we lose you?
I've got the Brent disease. I had my muted one. Also, this is from the same person. My license is suspended for tickets I did not incur. The car was in my name. The tickets came up to $4,000. What can I do?
I don't understand what they're saying. They got the tickets or they didn't get the tickets?
Well, he was not driving the car. Someone else was apparently driving the car, but the car was in his name. So when they wrote the tickets, it ended up on his tab.
Well, if it's parking and things of that nature, he's going to be held responsible for it. So, I don't know the details on that. I don't know what you know, they'd have to be more specific. If you can prove that you didn't get those tickets, then you shouldn't be a problem to go down to the court and clear that up. So, but again, I don't have enough detail to really comment too much more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is no more detail given either. People won't take no for an answer. Brent, have you gotten voice back unmuted? We've got two questions for you. We'll about do it. Calling Brent.
All right, we'll move on and we'll try to get him to look at those questions later on.
Okay.
Okay. Are there any other questions or any other announcements?
Oh, well, there is a question here. I'm not sure I can. I'll make a stab at it. Apparently, this person wants to file with us, but she had a case running, never filed a notice of default. Does she need to do that first or just proceed to the federal court? She wants to move whatever it is to federal court.
Well, if they defaulted, go follow up with the default before you do anything else and see where that goes.
Okay.
If they defaulted, the case is over. So, you got to file an affidavit of default in order to get a default. If they default, the judges are going to do much of anything, and no one's going to do anything for you, and it'll just fall away in X amount of months. They close the case and they move on. And then you'll lose your default. So it's up to you to push that default through. An affidavit of default is what's required. I think we have a copy of that on our website. The instructions to challenge jurisdiction, move your case for cause, file a habeas corpus, move the court for enforcement, notice and demand, some downloads, memorandums, landmark cases. I don't see, we may have an affidavit of default hidden in one of these things. Let me do a word search on this. I'm sure we'll find. Okay, yes, we do have an affidavit of default in challenging the jurisdictions. You'll find one. And you'll also, you'll find one in instructions and forms. Move your case for cause. Where else? You'll find them throughout. There's a couple places where we have it. Challenging jurisdiction is probably the best place to go, affidavit of default. So, again, that's on under education. Come down to court forms, process, and instructions. And as I mentioned before, I'm pretty sure to get to that page, you need to be a premier member, which, again, is someone giving $5 a month or more. And $5 a month or more is $60 a year. That's a cup of coffee and a bagel or a donut once a month. And that's it. Okay, anything else?
Well, the announcement, I'm sure you're going to cover this, John, about the meeting Thursday at 9 o'clock.
Correct.
For the indictment of Governor Northam. Okay, I won't say a word on it.
Okay. All right, quite a few things. Okay. First of all, I don't know that we sent a message out. I don't know if we sent it out on a weekly message, but we should put something in there on a constant basis that people can register for the militia now on our website for the within their county. It's the unorganized militia within your county, and we're writing up rules and regulations from across the United States. there's a lot of noise back there. I'm not sure. Before I go on with that, I see that Brent, looks like you can talk now. Go right ahead.
Well, I'm trying. Are you there? Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Do you want us to repeat those questions on the militia?
Yeah, I'll do the best you can. I'll listen. Go ahead.
All right. There are two questions for you. Jan, go ahead and repeat the questions to them,
okay,
one at a time.
The first question, can an inactive member of the National Guard or one simply between duty assignments serve in his local militia should the need arise? Also, if the guardsman's local militia were mustered while he was at home, would it be inappropriate for him not to serve alongside his neighbors?
Well, when you say not to serve alongside his neighbors, I would take it that you're saying serve with the militia unit, to make a choice between the National Guard and the militia.
Right.
And because the National Guard is not something that our Constitution of the United States expressly authorizes, in other words, delegates responsibility for, that's going to create a conflict that's going to end up probably, if you ignore National Guard duty, is going to get you charged under the UCMJ because you made a choice and went to join the militia. I'm not saying that's right. I'm predicting what would probably happen. This is the confusion that occurs when the government, the federal government, the general government in Washington, D.C., does things that the Constitution does not delegate authority to do. And the National Guard is one of those things. The National Guard looks like the militia of the several states of which our Constitution speaks, smells like it, but when you really look at it close, you see that that's not what it is at all. And some of the reasons we have gone over, for example, the National Guardsman, he is not allowed to take his weapon home. He's got to keep it in the armory at the National Guard headquarters, the National Guard station, whatever they call it now. And that's just one of the indications. And of course, there are other things about the National Guard that make it so it's not the militia. If you're not keeping and carrying your firearm, you aren't free to do that. That's not the militia. That's something else, and that's indeed what the National Guard is. But it was put in place, and people have called it the militia. The general government, the powers that be, want people to think it's the militia. It isn't. And so, because it's there, if you do get yourself in that position, and you're a National Guard member, and the militia gets called up, and the National Guard gets called up at the same time, then you've got to make a choice. And now, if the militia were recognized the way they're supposed to be, if the government recognized the militia, then they would probably, the government would give directives as to what to do in such a case. But since I know of no case where that's ever happened, where there's been a conflict and a man had to choose between one and the other, we have nothing in the way of precedent in our courts or in our court martials to tell us, that I know of anyway, I should say, to tell us what would be the right thing. But again, how can there be the right thing when there's unconstitutional false authority inserted into the mix of the facts of the case? And that's what you're talking about. Now, if you're a member of the National Guard and the militia is called up, the governor calls the militia up, or the president of the United States calls it up, or some part of it, well, then it seemed reasonable to me that you better answer the call, because if you don't show up and muster, then you'd be liable to courts-martial, to say it properly. You'd be liable in any case, because when the militia is called up, once the militiaman is mustered, then he becomes under the authority of martial law. In our case, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, as it is called, the UCMJ. He comes under that authority. And he becomes a part, if the president calls him up, he becomes a part of the armed forces of the United States. Now, since Congress, this gets confusing, and I know I'm talking a lot, but the more I talk, the more I think of the different scenarios. Since Congress has not done its job for many, many decades, and passed a uniform act for the training and the administration of the militia of the several states, and since the state legislature since the state legislatures have not done their job that the Constitution demands that state legislatures do and pass an act indicating what type of a firearm, what type of ammunition, what type of training, how officers are chosen, since they haven't done that, then we're at a loss to know what to do. And if the militia, which you can't get rid of, it's something, as we'd said last week, that you're born into. If you're an able-bodied male between the ages of about 20 and 45, some people suggest 60 because men are more healthy now. I don't know. That could be true. But at any rate, if you're able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle, then you're the militia. That's it. And you're the militia that could get mustered. No law can take that away. There's laws that maybe could be passed that say they take it away, but there isn't. And ignoring it won't ignoring the militia, as our Congress and as our state legislators have done, that doesn't make it go away either. They've ignored it now for well over 100 years, pushing more like 175. Oh, there's been some inklings of it along and as war arose up until World War I. I think I'd made mention that my grandmother used to tell me stories about Company B, which was the militia unit that was organized in that little town where I went to school when I was growing up. But that was back during the time, and she remembers it well, that Pancho Villa was making raids across the border, and Company B was called up to go to the Mexican border and help capture Pancho Villa. Well, we don't have those local units anymore. They've been quietly forgotten. So the question you're asking is somewhat hypothetical, but it's an important question, and it is something I hadn't thought of, and I'm glad you thought of it. But when the time comes, a fellow would have to make a choice. If he's a member of the National Guard, and he's called up to serve with the National Guard, and then also at the same time, either the president or the governor of your state musters the militia, and keep in mind that causes a conflict. Keep in mind the militia that is not under the authority of the four militia clauses of the Constitution of the United States is acting outside the law, and that's what we want to avoid, is lawlessness. But the militia must always be ready. Now, if things get really crazy, and things could get really crazy, all order could break down. At that point, there's no question. It's every man for himself to defend his family and his neighbors and to organize best he can. If the government is not going to organize, not going to appoint officers, the states are not going to appoint officers, and the Congress is not going to do its job, and the governors and the president of the United States do the job the Constitution tells them to do in those four militia clauses. In the case of chaos, invasion by a foreign force, insurrection, breakdown of good order, danger to everybody, then we must all do what we have to do to protect ourselves and our families and our homes. And to depend upon government to do it isn't going to work. And that's why the militia clauses are important. But I want to stress again, the militia is lawful when it's under the authority structure that the Constitution of the United States clearly sets forth, and it has set it forth clearly. Back to you, John, if there's another question.
Okay, yeah, I thought there was a second question, too. Go ahead, John.
The second question, when organizing the people's well-regulated state militia, do government employees need to be excluded?
I don't know anything in the Constitution of the United States that says government employees need to be excluded. However, I understand the problem, and I understand what the questioner is thinking. It's similar, as they say here, it's similar to ask the question, is it lawful that government employees serve on juries in federal tax cases, since they are paid by tax dollars? And that seems obviously unfair to put government employees on juries in a criminal tax case. But I know of nothing, no case where any court has held that that's unconstitutional. it doesn't seem right. But now let's go back to the militia. Should we exclude people that work for the government, bureaucrats of various stripes and sorts in the federal state government, from taking up arms and joining, being a part of the militia when they're mustered and called to duty? Again, I see no law and know of no law that says that they're excluded.
Okay. All right. So we'll go now. I guess we'll move on. There's no more questions there, Jan, right?
No, that was the end of them.
Okay. We're going to move on to Chuck in a minute here. But before we do that, just a couple of things. We did get the – we're going to have the militia course up. I was working on it today, uploading the course today. And Carl, if you're hearing this, maybe you can give me a call tomorrow and let me know that I'm doing it okay. I know last time there was something I missed. I'm not sure what that was. But anyway, I am struggling with it a little bit. So I'm kind of forgot something there, and maybe you can clue me in and let me know, make sure I'm doing it right. But I'm kind of hoping that I get this course up tomorrow, and then it'll be up to Carl to kind of open it up and activate it. And so I'm kind of thinking in the next 48 hours to 72 hours, that course should be up and going. So anybody wants to take that militia course, definitely can do that. Also, we have under people's duty on our blue bar, 1, 2, 3, the fourth from the right, we have people can join the committee man process and prepare for that. We have a lot of information on the committee man, so you can register to run for a committee man here. You can see all the committee men in your county once you register, but only registered committee men can see that list. So we do want people in their county to connect together. We also have some information on committee petition process. I think I'm going to be posting some more stuff up there. We're going to be posting a little more information on the times and the calendars that are available. Let's see. Brent, maybe you can mute yourself. We're hearing a little movement around.
Yeah, I'm in a vehicle. I'll try to do that.
Oh.
Thank you.
We'll mute you for you if you want.
Yeah, do that. If you don't talk to me, unmute me. It seems to be working that way.
Yeah, we'll unmute you, and if we when we have something, we can unmute you.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So anyway, under the people's duty, as I mentioned, we're laying out right now the times for walking. We'll be getting some more instructions. We do have somebody that is taking control as far as giving out information and answering questions. If anybody has any questions or concerns or they don't understand something, there's an email up there. It's jeff@nationallibertyalliance.org, and he should get back to you within 24 hours of any email he gets. Also, you can come here on a Monday night program and ask some questions, and we might be able to answer most of your questions. But we are working on certain details on each state when they're running. We're going to be posting up calendars and putting a lot more information on that petition page. So the petition process, on the one hand, is very easy, very simple, but there's some landmines in the petition, and you have to be aware of. It's very important to carefully go through the video up there. I think it's a 50-minute video on how to fill out the petition. And the guy who gives that that information, his name is Lenny Roberto, and he's very meticulous about the problems. So you want to really go through that very carefully and make sure you don't run into any problems, because they'll love to throw you off the ticket. And they will take any little cause they can to throw you off the ticket, and they'll throw you out. Also, there may be some – we're going to deal with different problems in that. They'll be listed up on the page that you want to be concerned with. We're going to lay out the program, how to go forward. And if you run into, any kind of roadblocks, we're kind of aware of most of the roadblocks, so we're going to list out if you run into a roadblock A, B, C, or D, whatever they may be, and how to get around them. So we'll give a lot of information on that. The other thing is people need to register for militia. This is your duty. Everybody should be registering for the militia, every male. And so you can go up here and you can make the register for this. This is for the unorganized militia. This is in your county. It's voluntary in the sense that, you know, you know, there's going to be certain rules and regulations and resolutions. There's going to be minimum requirement for all, and then there'll be a lot of other things for people, and you'll be as active as you want to be in that process. But there'll be a protocol set up within the county where the militia could be called out for by the sheriff. And I can think of a couple of ways that could be done very quickly and easily. With one phone call, everyone could be notified. So we'll work all those things out. We'll work it out with the sheriff. I'm not sure exactly how we're going to work this out as far as when it actually becomes an active militia. We're going to have to figure out how many members are required to do that. Maybe a half a dozen to get started, and then maybe start to approach the sheriff. But everyone that's going to register, and again, every male should register, even if you're over 45, you know, you could be 85, everyone can do something. Not that you need to be called out to come out if you had to defend. The younger men should be doing that. But there's a lot of other things the older men can do, and even women can help. But anyway, there'll be a lot of activities, and it could be actually a lot of fun because they can mix that with a lot of fun. Things going on a weekend here or there, especially in the summertime, and maybe occasionally for some who really want to get active, maybe go out on a week's excursion and something, and so on in the woods. But in any event, everybody should register. So you can go up online, you could register, you'll be piled into your county accordingly, and we're going to try to look for one person to really organize the county, or two. Could be more than one person, but we're going to be looking for one leader in the county for organizing. We're also going to lay out a program how to approach the sheriff and at what point in time you should approach the sheriff, but how to approach them is very important. We've got to be very careful on how we approach the sheriff because we want to woo him in to the process and lay it out in such a way he doesn't have a choice because the Constitution requires this. If he were to call Posse Comitatus, that would be the people to come out. There's some problems going on in Virginia, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, and that could happen any place. Could happen here in New York. As a matter of fact, it almost did, what's going on down in Virginia. Let me see what else we have here. So, again, you can register for, under the People's Duty tab, you can register to become a committeeman. You can register for the militia, and you can also register to become an administrator under that tab. There's other places you can do that, but it's also under that tab there. You can click on that and register. Now, under the grand jury tab, I just put a page up today. It's called an indictment consideration. And there's a consideration for indicting the governor of Virginia, which is what we're going to be talking about shortly. But anybody that would like to come in, anybody can come in to sit on this grand jury to hear and make a decision. The more people that come in, the better it is, of course, for us. But we're going to be considering an indictment on this issue on this Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here in this room. Let me repeat that. 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here in this room. We're going to be gathering together to vote yay or nay, for an indictment. The information could be read on the tab Indictment Consideration under the grand jury. So if you go up there, nationallibertyalliance.org, click on that tab, and read very, very carefully the information we have up there. We have referrals to different news medias where you can get all the information you need. We may post some other stuff. We're looking to post the actual, I think there are four bills that they're trying to get through. At least that's what I thought I saw. We'll find that out shortly. But we will post the bills up here, and maybe we'll highlight the particular areas. But I don't know how long the bill is going to be or whatever. But with or without that bill, we're going to take a consideration. There's enough newspaper articles, and there's enough statements by the governor himself that he has made himself guilty of treason, ultimately. I don't know whether we want to charge him with treason or not. We'll think that out. Maybe we'll make a vote, of course, on the different ways we can go with this. But anyway, anybody that can come to that and be part of that grand jury, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here in this room. And again, if you don't go up here and look at all the materials, please don't come, because we're only looking for people who are or who are really up to date on what's going on. And at the last minute, I would say on Thursday during the day at the latest, probably Wednesday was the latest, we'll post anything else. If we have anything more to post here, we will lay it out. We will lay out the information, put it onto this page. And so if you come up here, let's say Wednesday evening or Thursday morning, to take another view of this page to see if anything else has been added up. But people need to be up to date on what's going on down there in Virginia and what this governor is doing. And we'll just take it from there for next Thursday. It'll be a very short meeting. It doesn't take us long. Again, there's no discussion involved. It's really educating yourself and being at the meeting to cast your decision. Okay, we're going to unmute Chuck Thompson down from Virginia. He's going to talk to us a little bit about what's going on down in Virginia, and we'll see where we go from there. So, Chuck, I'm going to unmute you. You got the mic.
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Yep.
All right, good evening, everyone. This is Chuck Thompson. One of the founders of the National Militia Alliance. I'll put it to you like this. We, the people, are the power behind a constitutional government. The militia is the force behind that power. So basically, what I'm saying is that it's the people who give the force to our government. Our government are actually our magistrates. A magistrate is actually someone who is amenable to the people. A governor is a magistrate, according to the 1828 dictionary by Noah Webster. Any elected official or appointed official in government is a magistrate, again, according to the original Constitution and its meaning. So when you're looking at the Virginia Constitution, our elected officials are magistrates who are amenable to us. However, what we are not seeing at this time is that any of our officials being amenable to us. Instead, it seems more like they are spitting in our face, dictating how they're going to run us. And that is problematic for so many of us here in Virginia. And we know that also our eyes are watching us all over the nation. What happens here, if we fail, it will spread throughout the rest of the nation, and the nation will go down after us. So we cannot lose this in any way. So basically what we're looking at is everything that's going on. And one of the biggest problems I have with what's happened today is the red flag laws passed, but it's only the first pass. It doesn't mean that it's law. And even if it does become law, it will not become law until July 1st. So we have some time. So what we need to do is actually organize. I do not want to see violence of any type at any time, but I want to show a very strong showing of force. We can win this with the pen and with the showing of force, not with violence. If we go in with violence, we have lost completely. That is lawlessness, and that's something that we do not want at any time. So basically, the red flag law did actually get its first pass today, and the red flag laws are hideous. They're a violation of every single one of our rights on the Bill of Rights, and we cannot let that go. They may have passed in some other states, but they're already having some serious issues in other states. It can actually get to a particular point where all someone has to do is just say, my next-door neighbor, I think he has a gun, and he's rather dangerous. Next thing you know, that next-door neighbor has got some visitation by a whole bunch of police who are going to his house without a search warrant of any type whatsoever. And basically, they find out that Johnny next door never even owned a gun, but they found something else that they could charge him with, and so they do, and they take him away anyway. Due process is gone. Right to privacy, gone. Basically, you don't even get to ever see your accuser and know who your accuser is or was. They won't tell you that. That's all part of this red flag law stuff. Very dangerous stuff. It's not something that any of us want to see at all. All right, I think that's about all I have right at the moment. Back to you, John, unless anyone has any questions.
Yep, thank you. All right, well, we'll leave you unmuted for a moment if you want to pipe in. You know, look, until we have government by consent, these problems are going to continue to arise, and they're not going to get any better. Doesn't matter that Trump's in the office and what he's doing, because if we the people don't take control, especially when that power void takes place, when the deep state is finally drained out and these people are brought to justice, it's going to be a huge power void. Right now, we do not have government by consent. And we don't have government by consent because the people don't step up to take it. You know, they have to know how to consent to their government. And that requires some education. And that, of course, is why we have the course, government by consent course. People need to have the fundamental knowledge of how things work. They need to understand what liberty truly is. They need to understand how our courts work, the difference between law and equity, and what controls us and what doesn't control us, and the powers and the authorities of the people. If we controlled the committee man process, if the people were in control of that committee man process, then we would have government by consent for the political process because we would control that political process. It's not up to government to control that political process. It's up to the people to control that political process. And they do that through the committee man. But we need a minimum of 15,000 people. We can do it less than that, but 15,000 is really a desired number across this nation, 15,000 people. So everybody should be considering to become a committee man. All right. Now, the committee men can recall, and some states try to make it illegal to recall, saying, well, we don't have a law for recalling, so you can't do it. Well, look, it's a right of the people. It's right up to us to consent to government. We have the authority and the right to recall. There are quite a few states out there that actually have some statutes on the books to recall. But we don't need a statute to recall. We're free and independent people. We can recall on our own. Now, down in Virginia, in order to recall the governor, which is, I think, one of the things we're going to consider strongly doing, as a matter of fact, I think that is the main thing we should do. We're looking to do an indictment, and the main reason we're looking to do an indictment is because that individual is committing treason. He is using his governorship. He's using the position that he was elected into by the people, and he swore to defend and uphold and support that Constitution. Now, he or she may not agree with everything in that Constitution, may not agree or like the unalienable rights of the people, but they raised their hand and they swore to defend it, and that's an oath they took. And when that governor starts to move the legislature and starts to use his position as a platform to put forth ideas to take away the people's right to defend themselves and to defend their county and to defend their state and to defend their nation, then that person has committed treason. And so that's why we are going to consider treason for this individual. I think we're going to do something like that in New York, too. We have one particular senator, but we also have others. Matter of fact, both senators, but the one senator in particular, constantly talking about gun control. And we even have a governor here with the same kind of a problem. They pushed forward the SAFE Act, which we're still battling out here in New York. But the sheriffs are not stepping up to enforce this SAFE Act. I'm not sure exactly where things are going with that or where it's actually at, but I believe they've been passed and everything, but they're not enforcing it because the sheriffs say no. And that's how important it is for the people to know. If the sheriffs understand their positions, their duties, and they honor their oath, and they understand what their oath is, and they understand the Constitution, because they can't honor their oath if they don't know the Constitution. So if they know the Constitution and they honor their oath, these things just aren't going to go anywhere. They'll null and void, and the sheriff will say no. And the sheriff could call out posse comitatus if they try to pull the state police out. And trust me, there's no state police that's going to fire upon any kind of a sheriff, especially and the people who come out under posse comitatus. It's just not going to happen. Even the feds shake when you get a couple of sheriffs that come together and decide to kick feds out of particular counties, and they realize their authorities and their power. The feds get nervous and they leave. They will not step up. They will not fire upon or go up against the sheriffs. That's a for sure. And so that's how important this movement is that we're doing in order for people to get together in their counties. And again, you don't have to be very active in it, you know, but some people will want to be a lot more active than others. But we all should be participating in it. And again, we're going to lay out the rules, the regulations, and the resolutions that we are going to suggest to all of the county unorganized militias to, agree to, so we can be uniform across the nation. And then, of course, they'll be adding their other ideas and thoughts in it. But we also want to make it clear to those people who are organizing not to be so strict that you're going to have people not join and not participate. Again, some people want to be more active than others, and we have to appreciate that. Some people can be more active than others, and some people can't. And we have to appreciate that, too. So anyway, we're going to be putting that together, and we're going to be moving forward with this potential indictment for Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, this room. If you don't have the time to review the information on the page that we gave, and I'll give that page again, it is under the grand jury, second one down, indictment consideration. If you do not have the time when the day comes and you have not reviewed this information, don't come to the meeting to sit as a jurist, because you're not qualified. You don't know what's going on. But you have to thoroughly go through the evidence here on this page. It's not going to take you long. Reading a few pages here and a few pages there to see what's going on, the words of the governor himself and what they're pushing through. And it's time that we start indicting these people that are trying to destroy our unalienable rights. Remember, we don't have our rights because of the Bill of Rights. We have unalienable rights protected by the Bill of Rights. We just put them down there to say, hey, we better let you know, don't do anything to injure these particular rights. And by the way, we have more than this. Don't injure our rights. But the key ones we've listed out in the Bill of Rights to make it clear, and the right to defend, the right to bear arms, the right to gather as the militia. You know, I have to look into the Constitution down there in Virginia, and I'm sure the Constitution down there, you know, we're talking about Jefferson State, and he was involved with the Kentucky resolutions, and he was involved with the Constitution, and I'm sure they got things in there concerning not only to bear arms but on the militia. How can you be a militia if you can't have a weapon, a military grade weapon, in order to defend that county, to defend your neighborhood, your town, to defend your state, to defend your nation? You know, everybody needs a military-grade rifle, and Brent had brought it up. I think he said 500 rounds. Maybe I read that somewhere. Matter of fact, it might have been in his book. I don't remember. But, we should have X amount of rounds, and we will detail that in the regulations, the type of gun that everyone should have, type of weapon, and how much ammunition for that weapon. And everybody, of course, should have also a sidearm, a handgun. But particularly a military-grade weapon. This is our unalienable rights, and anybody who uses a political position in order to destroy our Constitution, to destroy our Bill of Rights, to trample upon our unalienable rights, they need to be removed from office. They are at the least case, they're in bad behavior. And the Constitution's call for anyone being in bad behavior to be removed from office. They get to stay in office as long as they're in good behavior. So anyway, we'll take a look at the Constitution down there. You cannot, you can't form a militia and protect the state or the county or your town, or be called out to, you know, posse comitatus to protect something in your county or whatever, without being armed. And they're taking that away from us. So anyway, anybody that's going to join us as the grand jury to make a decision on this, you need to be informed. So you need to read these pages and be fully informed, and then you can come and put in a vote. Now, every militia person particularly, and we're hoping to get a big movement out of this, not only down in Virginia, but also throughout the whole United States. We're looking to hopefully gain a lot of membership by working with organizing the militia. And every person that's joining the militia, you should become a committee man. Now, remember, you know, the militia became the committees of safety in history. They're the people that formed and organized, you know, in order for the revolution to take place, and eventually it turned out, you know, with the Declaration of Independence, and we became a nation, okay? But they were the ones that came together to form the Continental Congress, and they were the ones that fought the war, and this was the militia, and they became the Committee of Safety in order to form these things necessary to become a nation. And once we became a nation, the committees of safety morphed into the committee man. So there's a direct relationship between the militia and the committee man. And so right now, I think this is a good time for anybody joining up to be a militia to serve for 2 years as a committee man. You know, we're running for office in 2020 this year. And you will take office in January of 2021. So you'll be for 21 and 22, and then someone else will go into the office in 23. A lot of people will sign back up. Other new people will be coming in. But we need to fill these positions, and we need to take control. And the committee men are the people who decide who gets onto the ballot. The committee men are the people who would call up the sheriff. And just think of this, if you're the militia, you come to the sheriff as the committee man, because the committee man is the person who supports that sheriff to get them on the ballot. If that sheriff is in bad behavior and is a problematic individual and is not constitutional, the committee men are going to say, hey, we're not putting you on the ballot this year. Forget about it. They may even recall him. Matter of fact, they should recall him. But if they're coming up for a vote, they say, hey, you're not getting on the ballot because you're not doing what needs to be done. You're not educating yourself. You don't know the Constitution. If anything, you're destroying it through your ignorance, and so on and so forth. So it is when the committee men contact someone like the sheriff, we don't have to make them understand this. They already know this, because right now it's being controlled by party bosses. So they kiss the rings of party bosses to get into office, and that's why there's so much corruption and problem and lack of education. But if it's we, the people, that take control of this back, because they're not elected. They're private associations. They are not elected at all. We will become elected committeemen. They have to cease and desist. They go away. And now the people are in charge. And now the people are going to require an educated sheriff. The people are going to require the sheriff to work with the militia and to assist the militia, because the militia should be under the auspices of the sheriff. But they of course can organize, prepare, train, gather, and do all the necessary things to be ready for any kind of an emergency that might come up. And when an emergency comes up, if the sheriff doesn't call out for them, they still have the power and the authority to get up on their own and do what has to be done to protect their neighborhoods and their families, their neighbors, and so on. So again, becoming a committeeman only requires about 40 hours a year, no more. And it's an exciting time. It's during the election year, during the primary elections particularly, putting the people onto the ballot, interviewing these people that want to run for office. The odd years is a lot slower than the even years. you know, there's a lot more running for office on the even years than the odd years. Congress, all of Congress is wiped out every even year, and all of the congressional you know, subdivisions, political subdivisions, there's someone running for office for Congress. But a lot of the there's a lot more elections going on, individuals to be interviewed during the even years than there are in the odd years. But there's in both. So maximum 40 hours a year. And again, it's 2 or 3 hours here or there. It's in the evenings, and they may have something on a weekend, on a Saturday or something, where we gather together one time, usually sometime after we become elected, very early on, within the first 4 to 6 weeks. All committeemen gather together in their county, and ultimately in the state, really. They go to the state capitol is probably the place they would go. And they would gather together in order to divide themselves and organize all of the necessary committees, probably an 8-hour day, and that's only for the first year once you're elected. And then everybody then falls back into their, you know, political subdivisions within their counties. And if any meetings come up, it usually would be in a county committee. And sometimes, of course, if someone's running for Congress, you'd be meeting in your congressional district. And again, all that is organized and prepared for in that first meeting. But, you know, there's not much time in organizing, a couple of meetings here or there to organize these different subdivisions. Most of it is done on the state level. When you're together up there, you divide it up into different groups and work things out, organize, and then move on. There is, you know, other than organizing, most of the rest of the time is 2 hours here or 2 hours there in an evening during the time of preparing to put people onto the ballot for the primary elections. And again, it's a great job because you get to interview these people and you get to say no, no. You get to say to the people, you know, if you don't know the Constitution, go to National Liberty Alliance, take the course, come back, and we'll ask you some questions. And when we know you know the answers, then we will put you onto the ballot. And then we'll watch you like a hawk to make sure that you obey that Constitution, and if not, we're going to recall you. You see, that's the power of the committeeman. And right now, the militia, the people signing up for the militia, we're hoping to get a big surge with that. And if we do get a big surge with that, then, of course, we would like for these people to really take positions in the committeemen. But other people can take committeemen positions. Women could take committeemen positions, of course. People who are above the age, I think it's 45, it was mentioned. We're going to work that out in the uniform things, but maybe they don't want to get involved with the militia anymore after 45, but they may want to be the committeemen. But there'll be a working together between the committeemen and the militia at all times anyway. Because there's a close relationship. And even with the administrators for the juries, there'd be a relationship between those three groups because that's where we consent to government. That's true consent. And that's power and that's authority, and we can remove these people from office. So we will look into, I already started investigating things in Virginia in particular. If I understand it right, so far I think I understand it. You need 10%. Of the people to, you know, to sign the petition for recall of the election for the last governorship. Now, I saw some place where it said 25%, but I'm pretty sure I also saw the last thing I saw was 10%, so I don't know what that 25% was. That'd be awfully high to try to get that kind of a number. Right now, there's like 2.5 million people that voted for that in that election for governor. So we would need 10% of 2.5 million, that's 250,000 signatures. And they can't be from one county or a small group of counties or half the counties on one side of the state. No, they have to be spread throughout the state. So we will formulate a plan and to get these signatures out there. We'll be looking to a lot of the people that are stepping up to try to do something down in Virginia right now to actually take control of the petition process. We will lay it out on our site exactly how it works. We'll lay out all the paperwork, and we'll look to get the 250,000 signatures across the state, and we'll do a recall. if we do get an indictment, it'll be written in that recall that it's been indicted. Now, what Virginia has done, and some other states have done also, is they've permitted for the people to go out, and they have no law for it, okay? But it is written somewhere in their statutes that if the people do a recall, then the final decision of that recall is made by the Supreme Court of the state. Okay, now that, in my opinion, is still repugnant because who is the Supreme Court of the state thinking that they're more powerful and have more authority than the people? You know, we the people, we are the ones that make the decision in courts of law. They run courts of equity. We're talking about law. We're talking about unalienable rights. We're talking about something that they are only there to protect, okay? And so they should have no business in this process. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. We'll do the paperwork. We'll submit it. And we'll see what kind of a decision, if they pull, and they probably will pull it into the Supreme Court of the state of Virginia. And if they do the wrong thing, we'll overrule them. Because we're running a court of record, and we'll overrule them through the federal level to protect the unalienable rights of the people. We'll be moved to federal court for cause. Okay? So we're creating that plan. We're going to post all that information up, and we're going to move forward with it. But again, this is something that the committeemen would be doing. Virginia would not have this problem. First of all, if the people ran the committeeman process down in Virginia, the sheriff would, I'm not the sheriff, the governor and the legislators voting for these bills or considering to vote for these bills, they would get a call from the state committee, chairman, and they would be told to cease and desist. And do you know what? The governor would cease and desist, and so would all the other individuals. Why? Because we control their job. We can remove them. But the power, the people don't have that power because they're ignorant to that power. They need to learn about that power, then they need to step up and take that power. So again, when this void, and this void is already here and it's already starting, it needs to be filled now. We need to educate ourselves now. We need to prepare to run for these positions now. We need to fill these positions this year, and we need to take control of the entire process in 2021. And that's our goal. We have one whole year to do this, but we don't have a year to make a decision. We don't have a year to get educated. We only have a couple of months to get educated. This decision needs to be now. It's a no-brainer. Step up, sign up on to become a committeeman on National Liberty Alliance. Just go up to the People's Duty and just fill out the form and sign up. Become a militia. Become, you know, register for the unorganized militia, and also sign up to become a committeeman. And people who are looking for a good job, you can sign up to become. And this is a paid. This is one that's paid. The administrators for the juries, the grand and petit juries. It's a paid position. Anybody who wants a good career, then they can go sign up for that too. There's four people in every county. We're looking for four people in every county. And you don't have to work in the county you live, by the way. It's a job. So four people in every county to take these positions, paid position, full-time job, very rewarding job. You get to orientate the juries. You get to protect the juries, make sure that they are not, you know, poisoned by the judge or by the prosecutor. And we get to assist them in writing the papers for their decision and for the grand jury particularly. The magistrate in a court, he is to really write down the will of the jury and execute whatever it is that they decided in that court case. But the administrators would definitely be watching these people, you know, the magistrates, like a hawk, because they could abuse their power, and we're not going to let them. But again, the people expect to be ignorant and free. Forget about it. It's not going to happen. So people need to step up and take responsibility and do their duty. Sign up. Sign up now. Sign up today, tomorrow. Get connected. Get educated. Let's do it. Okay. Chuck, do you have anything to add to any of that?
Yes, I do. I'm going to jump in for just a moment. I've got the Virginia Constitution in front of me, the Bill of Rights, and the Section 13 that we were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
That a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. That standing armies in time of peace should be avoided as dangerous to liberty. And that in all cases of the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power.
Okay, so right there is in the Constitution itself, we are going to use that as part of the position of our case, okay? And again, we've got a lot of ways to approach this, but one of the first ways we want to approach it is first consider an indictment. We need to move on that quickly because I think within the next week or so we need to prepare the papers and lay out a plan and get it up on the website and how to go about doing this. And in that process of the petition, why we're getting rid of this guy or want to get recall this guy is because, A, number one, if he gets indicted, that will be in there that he's been indicted. But his assault on the Constitution, his denial of the Constitution, his breaking of his oath by trying to change the Constitution through legislation, which is not possible, and especially it's not possible to take away or to change an unalienable right. That's not part of anything that they have any authority to do.
I'm going to jump in with one more thing, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
Right at the end there, again, it says the civil power. And there's a lack of understanding of what the civil power really is. In regards to what they were talking about, the civil power back in that time period, the civil power is we the people. Civil power today is assumed to be actually our elected officials, and that's not the case. Maybe that's the way they try to describe it today, but its original intent was the civil power was we the people.
Well, we will lay the position out very clearly because there are two different levels of the militia. One is the organized and the other is the unorganized. And the unorganized will also be organized, of course, because we'll organize ourselves. Look at between the United States Constitution and also the Constitution for Virginia, and we may even use other constitutions, there's no way that these people are doing what they're doing in any lawful manner, and any court that is just would agree with it. So if the Virginia Supreme Court was to view the papers and look at the reasoning behind why the recall and with the people, then they will have to do the just thing. And if they don't do the just thing, we will move it into a court of record on the federal level for cause. And we'll take it away from them and bring it into the people. And first we'll see if we can get an outright decision from the United States Supreme Court. And if not, then we'll take it ourselves. But summary judgment is the appropriate thing on something that is obvious in order to protect the right. And that's why we go to federal courts for cause. We're looking for the judge to do the right thing. You know, when we bring a case because one of our rights were violated, it's a no-brainer. There's nothing to talk about. As long as you can show by affidavit number one and show the fact that that you have been abused in some way by a lower court, there's no decision-making. There's nothing for them to think about. It's just they have to protect the Constitution, the people, their unalienable right, the right of due process. They have to protect that. And when they don't, it's clear as day, we'll just take it away from them and we will make a decision. Because, look, we are free and independent people. This is our government. We control them. Right now they're controlling us, and they're controlling us because we're lazy, we're ignorant, and we're not stepping up to do the right thing. Let's get educated. Let's get up there and be free, make our statements, and take control of our life and our nation and bring it the right direction. So it's up to us to do it. Okay, anything final, Chuck, before we move on?
I can keep going. Unfortunately, I'm going to give you one more. Section 2 of the Constitution of Virginia, that all power is vested in and consequently derived from the people. The magistrates are their trustees in service and at all times amenable to them.
Well, there you go. Okay, thanks a lot, Chuck. Okay, we're going to move on. Jen, there's nothing more for us to cover. We can move on.
No, there's nothing more.
Okay. All right, Brent, do you want to talk tonight? I know you. I think you're traveling. I don't know if you want to talk tonight or what. Let me unmute him. Let me unmute Brent.
Yes, I'm.
Okay, you're unmuted.
I'm willing to say a few words.
Go right ahead. You got the mic. This is Brent Winters, the author of the Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, go right ahead.
Thank you. And I better talk while I can be heard. My name is Brent Alan Winters. Website, as John said, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And you can find my books at Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Alan Winters, and they'll come up. One of those books is called The Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies, both foreign and domestic. And you can see how to obtain a copy there. There are four militia clauses, as we had said. And we'd gone over the first militia clause, I believe, last time. But I'll review it quickly. Just read it. Well, let me say this. The first militia clause gives Congress authority to provide a standing rule to govern the president as he decides whether or not to call forth any of the militia of the several states and to provide regulations to govern a militiaman, but only when mustered in the service of the United States. Congress, however, has neither direct nor final power to force anyone to follow these rules and regulations. Let me repeat that. According to our Constitution of the United States, Congress has neither direct nor final power to force anyone to follow the rules and regulations concerning the militia that it sets forth. Well, why doesn't it? Because the Congress of the United States is not the law-enforcing power. The Congress of the United States is the legislating power. And if there's anything fundamental to our common law government, and that's what we are, we're a common law government, we're not a democracy, and we're not even a republic in the sense that people say the word. No, in a republic, the legislative body is sovereign, controls everything. That's not who we are. We have a republican form of government, our Constitution says, but we're not really a republic. Communist countries are republics and call themselves republics. The confusion of words is rife among even patriots, and we would do well, I believe, to be careful how we use words. What are we if we're not a republic or a constitution, strictly, or a constitutional government we are? If we're not a republic or a democracy, strictly speaking, well, what we are is a common law government. We have a common law government. That means the powers are separated. The legislative power has no executive power, neither does it have judicial power. And the other two branches of government only have the power they have. And in a common law country like ours, if it's operated right, those three powers, those three branches of government that grow from the trunk of the tree called the Constitution of the United States are utterly independent one from each other. They don't tell each other what to do. Oh, they can tell each other what to do, but there's nothing in our law that says they have to do what the other one says. There's nothing in our law that says, for instance, that the courts have to do what the president says and vice versa. No, every person is responsible to make a decision as to what is lawful, that is, in our case, what is constitutional. The first militia clause says this, says the Congress, there's the legislative power, shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia. Provide, that means to write regulations by which the president of the United States is to measure a situation, whether it be insurrection or invasion. He wants to decide whether he has authority to call forth the militia for any of the reasons the Constitution sets forth. Well, the Congress provides the measuring stick used to decide whether or not he can do that. And they're to do that. They have not done that for a long, long time. And they are to provide also regulations for organizing, arming, disciplining the militia of the several states, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Well, you could argue that the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that all armed forces of the United States fall under, is the law that the militia, once mustered, once a militiaman is mustered, he falls under that law. In that sense, Congress has acted, but they haven't done their whole duty. The first of four militia clauses empowers Congress alone to set standards and rules governing when, on what conditions, and how the President of the United States shall call forth the militia for service. Now keep in mind, the President of the United States and the governors of the several states have concurrent jurisdiction over the militia in any given state. And whoever calls forth the militia or any part of them first and has them mustered, the other one can't by law. That's what our law says. Why do we say that? That's our common law. That's the way it's designed. Our Constitution doesn't cover all these matters. That's why we must repair back to our common law to know how to fill in the blanks, because the Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. It doesn't fill in very many blanks. It gives general first principles that we are to follow. Congress's power to set these standards is non-delegable. That means they can't delegate it to the president. If they do, they're still answer for it. No president, therefore, has the right to decide by his own standard, or lack thereof, whether an invasion or a local insurrection, an uprising, warrants his calling up the militia. If the Congress of the United States neglects to provide this standard, and it has, its members have failed their sworn duty to our Constitution, and they have failed that duty. Congress's duty to provide a standard for when and how to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions needs be cast in a standing order, so that any emergency caused by any of these three threatening events, the President of the United States can act using Congress's standards with necessary dispatch. If the emergency meets Congress's preset standards, the President then is to call forth any of the state militias needed. But what if he believes Congress's standards are unconstitutional? Well, then he has a bounden duty by oath to disregard what they have said. Yeah, that's the way it's supposed to work. It's a constant, never-ending. Common law government is a constant, never-ending Mexican standoff. And if you want to know what a Mexican standoff is, go back and watch that old 1967 movie, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, with Clint Eastwood. And the final the final scene of that movie is a three-way Mexican standoff, a gun battle. Well, that's what our government is at common law. And the beautiful thing about common law government is there is no final authority trumping power. No, because men are not to be trusted with having gathered all three of those powers into a single will, a single set of hands, whether the single set of hands of one man or the single will of a legislative body. Well, as with the old Anglo-Saxon king's authority, remember our common law arose in its most recent recorded understanding in the country of England. As with Anglo-Saxon king's authority over the Fyrd, F-Y-R-D, which was the old Anglo-Dane word for militia, the President of the United States is the sole judge using the standard of Congress, the standard Congress has provided, of whether any of the three, let me see what I've got here, exigencies, that's a big word, any of the three exigencies our Constitution lists requires him to call out any state militia or any part thereof. A related common law and constitutional duty is the juryman. Remember, the militiaman has two duties, and those two duties are jury duty and armed defense. Jury duty and armed defense. And that's the foundation of our oath, an ancient common law oath going back centuries that we still use, that everyone in federal and state government and in our military services is bound to take, and they do take it, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign, that's the duty of armed defense, and enemies domestic, that's the duty we call jury duty. That's the basis of that oath. Because all government fundamentally, at bottom, the truly lawful functions of government are armed defense and what we have come to call justice. Government is to provide justice, is to do it. Is it doing it? Not much. But the way it does it, it's supposed to do it, is through what we call courts and juries. And it is the militiaman's duty in both of those cases to be the government, to be the, a while ago, Chuck used the word power. I understood the distinction he was making between power and power and force. I get it. But I like to use, instead of the words power and force, I like to use the words authority and power. But in either case, we don't have consistency in our legal tradition as to which are the words, which of those two sets of words are best. But there is a distinction between what I call authority, the right to do something, the responsibility, and the raw force to get it done. And in this case, for instance, Congress is given authority to set standards, but Congress is not given the raw force to get it done. Who's that given to? That's given to the President of the United States and the governors of the several states. And their authority from there, given, delegated to their, those under their authority, is their power, is to use their power. Those three words are, they're synonymous and they get mixed up some, but there is a distinction between what I call authority and power. Let me read something about the second militia clause. As long as I've got juice, I've still got some left. The second militia clause reserves, not grants, but reserves to each state. Why doesn't it say it grants to each state? Because the Constitution of the United States doesn't grant anything to the states. The states are the ones with law, through the people that created the Constitution. So that's why our Constitution says the second militia clause reserves to each state, not grants. The states are what grants things through the militia to the federal government. It's the other way around. Grants reserves alone the executive, the exclusive power to choose and appoint officers for its own militia, and the exclusive right to train and discipline its own militiamen. This second militia clause is careful to say that these powers are not granted but reserved to each state, because each state already has these powers and has never given them to any other. Simply put, because the national government has never had these powers, it is impossible that the national government can grant these powers to the states. In short, one cannot impart that which one has not possessed. On 17 May 1847, President Polk, P-O-L-K, offered Jefferson Davis a federal commission as a brigadier general and command of a brigade of his state's militia. Now, Jefferson Davis became later on president of the Confederacy. He was from the, well, he actually was born in Kentucky, like Abe Lincoln, but he wound up in a county in Mississippi, and he was a graduate of West Point, so he was qualified for the position that the president wanted to give him, brigadier general of the state militia. But Jefferson Davis declined these appointments because our Constitution gives the power of appointing militia officers not to the federal government, but to the states. And Jefferson Davis told him that. See, that's an encroachment. And that's how we lose our freedoms, because when governments do these kinds of things, if Jeff Davis had said, oh yeah, okay, I'll accept that commission, that would have eroded to that degree our freedoms, because it would have eroded the militia clauses and the way they operate. It would have set a bad example. The second militia clause says this, a bad precedent is a better word. It says this, reserving to the states respectively, reserving, you see, not delegating, because the states already have this authority, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. See, everybody has a duty here. Congress has a duty to put forth a manual of discipline, a manual of arms, to make it real simple, a manual of arms, how the militia is to learn to respond to orders, for instance. How they're supposed to march. I'm being real fundamental here. I know it's probably not as important as it used to be, but however that principle applies, about face, oblique left, oblique right, forward march, right shoulder arms, etc., Congress has the responsibility of promulgating through the legislative powers to all of the states the manual of arms they are to use. That's what it's saying. But each of the states, then, under our Constitution, that's reserved to them to retain that duty to drill them in the manual of arms. Now, I don't know all the details. I wish I had time to go back and look at all this. My grandmother used to tell me about Company B. I'd mentioned that a while ago. And she says she remembers them. There's a little open area out on the edge of town where I remember when the circuses used to come there and set up their tents. But it was an open area, kind of a park kind of an area. And that's where Company B, she said, used to get together on weekends and they would show off. Probably for the girls, I don't know. They would show off their ability to march, and they had their rifles, and they would count cadence and do those kind of things. Well, that's called manual of arms. And if it's not uniform throughout the United States, if the president calls forth the militia, let's say, because of a local problem or a local invasion, calls together the militia of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. Well, Congress has provided a uniform manual of arms, then the militias of those three states would all be able to respond and be drilled and understand the same commands, and there would be order. A militia, there is no unity in a militia without unity of action and thought and order. That's why military discipline is so important. Americans have never amended this second militia clause. It is straightforward in its meaning, and its reading gives the right understanding. Again, National Guard units are not the militia. By the word militia, the American colonial signified both the separate militia of the several states, each one, having yet to answer any call to muster, and the separate militia of the several states having answered the call to muster and having mustered. The militia in the colonial period, says the Supreme Court of the United States, I'm quoting, let me start that quote again. The militia in the colonial period consisted of the people, male, M-A-L-E, as opposed to female, able-bodied, and within a certain age range. I'm continuing to quote the Supreme Court of the United States. Although the militia consists, consist, and this is a recent case, 2008, consist, that's present tense today, of all able-bodied men, the federally organized militia, it says, may consist of a subset of them, called forth in a local place to meet a local threat. What they're saying is, if the president calls forth the militia in a local place to meet a local threat of invasion or insurrection, the president has the authority to do that. He doesn't have to call all of the militia forth, and likewise, if the governor of your state calls forth the militia of four counties down at the southern end of the state and not anybody else, he has the authority to do that. Or he may call forth the militia of the entire state. He has authority to do that. And remember, his authority is what the law calls concurrent with the president's authority to call forth the militia, and whichever one calls forth the militia first, well then, he has control of the militia. I'll end with this. My brother brought this up to me. It was something we were talking about recently in regard to this problem down in Virginia. And he said, well, this whole situation could be trumped if the governor of Virginia calls forth the National Guard to enforce these draconian orders he's given about firearms, to confiscate them from people. Well, if Trump beats him to the punch and calls forth the National Guard, then there would be no National Guard to follow the orders of the president. See, that's the way that would work. Now, the National Guard is not the militia. I'm using that as an analogy. Let's say that, this would be a good one, the governor calls forth the militia of the state of Virginia to confiscate firearms. That probably wouldn't work, would it? Good thing. See, that's the power of the militia. It creates a problem for lawless government officials. And that's why the militia, our Constitution, recognizes it. I'll tell one story about the militia, and I've told it before, but I think it bears repeating. And this is just a simple story from the Bible. And it's about the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel when they were wandering in circles in the wilderness for 40 years. That's all about the militia. That's why the book of Numbers records what happened there. It's all about the numbering of the militia. Twice in that book, the militia was numbered. And in both cases, at the beginning of that 40-year period and at the end of that 40-year period. But all during that time, poor Moses, he was the leader. Poor Moses, I said it was a tough job. He was the leader of this bunch of Israelites. And they often didn't do what God wanted them to do. They got pretty nasty, and Moses would try to intercede for them before the Lord God of heaven and earth itself, himself. And one time he got frustrated, and God told him what to do, and Moses got really frustrated because he knew if he did what God told him to do, that he would be in trouble. In trouble with who? Well, let me put it this way. Listen to what he said to the Lord God, maker of heaven and earth. He said, I don't think you understand, God. There are over 600,000 armed men, footmen, in the camp. Over 600,000, that's right. The first time they were numbered, it was 601,550. And throughout that time, and even up until the end of that 40 years, numbered again before they went in to split the land of Canaan in two and conquer it, the militia of the 12 several tribes, there were still over 600,000, a different bunch, but it was about the same. You see, Moses, as leader of Israel, the point I'm trying to get across here, as leader of Israel, and I'm not saying he was a bad guy, no, he was usually on the right side, but still, the Bible records that he was afraid of the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel. He didn't want to have to face them. And that's why God has established, as the prototype of all governments, that the militiamen had been called by different names. It was called the people, the Old Testament, the Hebrew phrase, ha'am, translated the people. That's what the militia of the 12 several tribes was called there. Our Constitution of the United States calls the militia of the several states the militia of the several states. That means of the individual states. And it's a very important component, an indispensable component to our freedom. Without it, without its recognition, without us as a people recognizing it, we don't even know today, most of us, the majority of Americans, don't have a clue who the militia is. Ask them to define who the militia is. They couldn't tell you. Why is that? Because we, who's to blame? We are. Because we haven't educated children. We haven't told them. We haven't educated young people. We haven't made it known to others. It's our duty as law-abiding Americans to know what the fundamental law is and to safeguard it from erosion and to do it. That takes effort. It's not enough to pound the Constitution of the United States like a fundamentalist would pound the Bible and say, I believe this. Well, most of the fundamentalists who pound the Bible, not all of them, but most of them, they don't even know what's in the Bible. And most people don't know what's in the Constitution. Therein lies the problem. God commands that we are to know our law, the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of creation. And the laws of nature's God, as our Declaration of 76 puts it, that's the law written in the Bible. Blackstone tells us that that's what those two phrases mean. That, friends, neighbors, and kin, constitutes the fundamental law we have as Americans. Only two volumes, the law unwritten in the nature of things, we also call that our common law, and the law written in the Bible. That's it. These and no others, these and no more. And things get so crazy, so lawless, that the only remedy for lawlessness is true law. I believe it's time that we recognize the reality that when a people, I'm quoting somebody very famous, I can't remember who it was, but he who never quotes is never quoted, so I'm going to quote him. When a people find themselves in a crisis, history bears it out, they inevitably turn their eyes toward their origins and look there for a sign. They turn their eyes toward their origins and look there for a sign. Well, that's the way God made us. We're turning our eyes toward our origins as Americans, and we're looking for a sign, something to point out the way. Well, it's there. Let's look, and let's listen, and let's then act upon it by being law-abiding Americans. Back to John or Gerard. Thank you very much. My comments are my own, by the way. May or may not comport with National Liberty Alliance, but in most cases I find they do. But it's important that I say that at the end. I have to talk about the law of God and the law of our Constitution according to the light that God has given me. Back to you.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Gerard, are you going to take the mic here, or shall I? If you're talking, you're muted. All right, I guess I'll move forward until Gerard gets back. Okay, we'll take our first caller. Let's see. Looks like California Fred. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hello, John. Good to see you again. I think Brent answered one of his questions, you know, regarding the militia being called up and the National Guard. During the Civil War, they had that same problem where people were in the military and they had to make a choice between going back to their state to become a member of the militia in the Confederacy or stay in the service of the federal government under the wrong flag. And they were allowed to make that choice. It would seem to me that someone that's serving in the militia and in the National Guard, whichever he joined first, he would have to write an exclusionary clause in his agreement on signing again and be accepted into the service of the National Guard then that way. That would leave him the out.
Well, I would imagine that if anybody was in the National Guard and also joined up with the local unorganized militia, I don't really see a conflict there. Of course, if they're in active, something active taking place on the unorganized side, but they're called at the same time to the National Guard, and I guess they would have to go there. There is a problem, as Brent has mentioned, with the National Guard. The first of all, I don't think they ever should have used the name. They should have called it the militia, not the National Guard to begin with. And the militia of the several states. So each state should have its own, statement as far as what state they are, but they should be a militia. But there are some problems, of course, as Brent has brought up, and we need to go through those. You can find this in the Dix Act. That all of the details concerning the National Guard, but we the people can fix this. We have to have government by consent first, and we're not going to have government by consent until we learn how to have government by consent. Then step up and take the power and the authority and do it. Take control of our government, and thereby have government by consent. We could deal with all these political problems. All this politicking does not belong. This is the enemy created this. This is not created in our system. There's no room for it. If our system, if we were exercising the Constitution and requiring the people that are elected into these offices to exercise the Constitution as written and by what authorities we have given them, there'd be no room for politicking. It just wouldn't be. This problem between the Democrats and the Republicans, it just would not be. But people don't know these things. They're ignorant to them. They don't understand it. But they can understand it by taking the course. If a people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. We have to control our courts. We have to control the political process. We have to put these people back under the chains of the Constitution. And until we do that, we're not going to have the government that we have been founded in, that we have inherited. So we have to fix these problems. We can fix the militia problems. This problem that people are talking about, which I still don't see, I did get a paper sent to me with the USMCA. I do not see what these people are talking about. I did get a hold of the law. And if people want to discuss this, we can discuss it. So I'm not going to get into the detail at this moment. I looked up some of the law that they referred to. Some of the numbers and chapters that they referred to don't even exist in the law, so I don't know where that's coming from. Maybe I'm missing something, but it's not there. But the major focuses of the particular code that they had written, I forget what it's called, HR something. Let's see, maybe I could tell you. It's Bill 116, HR 543-0. Goodness, is that an IH? Looks like an IH. Let me open it up. Well, HR 5430. Okay, the 116th Congress, first session. So I haven't gone through all of this, but I went to the places that was referred to in these areas, and it does not say what they say it says. So, you know, we have to be careful what we jump into. Maybe the enemy is putting this together, and maybe the enemy is causing problem and havoc, and maybe the enemy is saying, well, this group here, you know, they're the group that brought this out. But, you know, the paper I have, there is no referral to any particular group, like the John Birch Society or anything like that. I don't see that on the paper at all. So I don't know where this paper comes from. Jan, I know you got that from me. Do you know where that paper came from that you gave me concerning this problems with USMCA?
One of them came from John Birch Society.
Okay, well, I don't think it did because John Birch Society's name is not on it, and I can't believe that the John Birch Society would say the things that they said in there, and then when I go look at it, it doesn't say that. But again, if people want to discuss that, we'll get back into that. Let me go back to the caller on that.
John?
Yep.
I have another question that's probably, it's a dynamite question. Voting. Here in California, we've got these illegal aliens that are voting. We've got people that are actually giving them out ID cards like they're doing in New York so they can vote. What would Mr. Brinkers and Witters have to say about that?
What would what?
The voting in America. What does it take to vote? Originally, you had to own property.
Well, look, you need to be a citizen of the United States and of age 18 now. And that's what's required to vote, nothing more, nothing less. If you're not a citizen, you don't have a right to vote. So you have to be a citizen, either born or made a citizen. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, again, there's nothing in our Constitution requiring people to be property owners. So, anything else? Anything else on that, Fred, or that's it?
Well, back in the states used to require you to be a Christian and a property owner to vote.
Well, that's not in our Constitution. That might have been something in the past, in the beginning. They may have reason for that. I don't know how true that is. I've heard people speak about it. I have not seen that in history myself. I've seen people refer to that. But I everything to me is suspect. You know, who was it? Reagan, I think, that says, trust but verify. And I've come to that point in my life quite some time ago. When anybody tells me anything about law, about our heritage, about our history, I'm going to trust, but I'm going to verify. I have gotten egg on my face way too many times, trusting in people that I thought knew what they were talking about, or you know, seemed to know what they're talking about, and then I start to regurgitate what they say, and all I'm doing is regurgitating something that's not true. And I stopped that a long time ago when I realized the problem. And that's why with this USMCA, not that there's not any problems in that law. I'm sure we can find some, but that doesn't mean we can't fix them. But anything repugnant to our Constitution and the laws of the states that are constitutional or the laws of the United States as far as the federal level is concerned that's constitutional cannot be affected by something else. There's what's called, construction of law. And we do realize that that exists. And they play a lot of games with that, for instance, in USC 26, because that's what the enemy did. But I haven't seen anything in this, but I have not reviewed or through all of this HR Let me open that number again so I can say what it is. It's HR5430. I haven't seen it. You know, the only thing I did see in there that kind of trumps anything was a reference to vehicles. You know, Mexico has a certain requirements concerning their vehicles, let's call it motor vehicle law down in Mexico, whatever you want to call it. I'll call it that to make it easy for us. And maybe there's a Canadian motor vehicle law. And then there's the United States motor vehicle law, you know, the federal, and there's also state levels. And I'm not sure, I'm not even sure whether it's governed by the federal right down into the states and how all that works, but I think it is running from, it could be in the states, because it's New York State Motor Vehicles, for instance. So you have these different requirements on vehicles. We're talking commercial vehicles now, okay? And so all those requirements. The only thing I saw in there was saying that, you know, Mexico would have theirs and they couldn't be held liable by our law concerning the requirement of the commercial code and requirement of the vehicles and vice versa. You know, us as American vehicles going into Mexico or over to Canada, you know, we can't be held, you know, in some kind of a problem. Qualifying under a particular code or whatever it is that they've written on that. So that I did see. Other than that, I didn't see anything else. The referral to the problems, okay, what I saw, and this came from the paper that Janice shared with me that says comes from the John Birch Society, which I don't believe it did. It doesn't have – John Birch Society would have put their name on this paper, and they didn't. So someone's saying it's from the John Birch Society – are we just going to trust that? Then they refer it. They say, here's the big one. Above the United States and state law, sections 102 and 508, the USMCA can require any U.S. or state law to conform to the act, thus nullifying our laws and removing the American people from governmental representation, denying a republican form of government, and it goes on to some other things. There's no redress for the states and individuals. The laws conforming to USMCA Section 102, the states and the individuals are specifically pointed as having no legal redress against the changes in laws made to conform to the USMCA. This means loss of judicial participation for the people and the removal of checks and balances in the system. I mean, this sounds pretty drastic, okay? But I went and I read the law when they referred to 508 and 102. And it doesn't say anything. As a matter of fact, it says the exact opposite of that. And let me just read 102. I don't want to get too lost in this. I think I'll post this stuff up somewhere where people can go look at it and maybe they can research it a little deeper to see if there's anything we're missing here. But here's section 102 they refer to. And it says the relationship of the USMCA to the United States and state law. The relationship. So it goes on. United States law to prevail in conflict. No provision of the USMCA nor the application of any such provision to any person to circumstance which is inconsistent with any law of the United States shall have effect. Construction. Nothing in this act shall be construed to amend or modify any law of the United States or to limit any authority conferred under any law of the United States unless specifically provided for in this act. And I did see on the commercial vehicles that was, I guess, what they're talking about particularly. Maybe some other things that I haven't seen yet, but I haven't seen anything more than that. Then it goes on to say, so the construction, nothing in this act shall be construed, A, to amend or modify any law of the United States, or B, to limit any authority conferred under any law of the United States, unless specifically provided for in this act. Relationship of the USMCA to state law. Legal challenge. No state law or the application thereof may be declared invalid as to any person or circumstances on the grounds that the provisions or application is inconsistent with the USMCA, except in an action brought by the United States for the purpose of declaring such law or application invalid. So what I have noticed when I've looked into codes and, you know, there's 57 different codes on the federal level, and whenever they make a change in the law, okay, sometimes that affects other things, and they have to review all the codes. They have to be expert in this stuff. And they'll go in and make some changes to conform with this and that. That all happens, okay? But nothing is going to be unconstitutional. Nothing is going to just render a law null and void. If anything, they would be null and void according to this right here in this particular code or bill that's been written up in HR 5430.
John?
So people can look in here. I'm going to post it up and people can read further, and if they can find some conflicts, we'll talk about it. But right now I'm not seeing anything. But I will say that the way they wrote, whoever wrote that paper up was not honest with the way they wrote it up. They quoted it but reversed everything. Go ahead.
I need to make one quick comment about all of this.
Yeah.
Not very long ago, President Trump said California emission standards would not be adhered to, that the federal standard would be good enough.
Okay.
And that was part of the prerequisite of this, is so California couldn't be a stick in the mud requiring different smog applications than the other 50 states.
Well, wherever the federal government was given authority by the Constitution on Article 1, Section 8, then they preside over the law of any state. So if there's a conflict between state law and federal law where the federal authority was given constitutionally, the federal authority is going to overrule all the time. And that makes sense, of course, in order to be uniform. And we gave most of the commercial, for the purpose of uniform codes across the United States. So that's why we gave them certain authorities. And we've laid it out in Article 1, Section 8.
No. Well, I'll let you get on to someone else's question, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. Gerard, are you back yet?
Hey, John.
Yeah.
That document came from the American Policy Center.
Who are they?
The other one I sent you came from the John Birch Society. It was not glowingly supportive either.
Okay. Do you have one from John Birch?
I do. I can send you the...
Drop it in my Skype, and if it's too big, put it up on File Depot, and I'll get it. And I'll take a quick look at that and see. It should be only a couple pages, I presume, or is it a long document?
No, it wasn't too long. They had like 5 main points, so it was very short.
And it probably made references to certain points. You know, one of the problems I also saw in this document that you sent to me, it referred to, Section 102 and 508. Those are two big things. And both of them say the exact opposite of what they're saying. 100% opposite of what they're saying in this paper. Then it refers to some other things and refers to a Chapter 30, okay, and Chapter 1 and Chapter 20. There are no chapters. And then I said, well, okay, there are titles. Maybe they mean that they're referring to Title 1 or Title 30 or Title 24. And I was looking there, and that didn't work out. You know, it just doesn't comply. It doesn't relate to what they're saying here or there. So I don't know what that's all about, where they're getting that. So maybe that's in some other reference to some other titles or codes, which would be on a federal level. I don't know. But anyway, Jan, yeah, send me that paper. I'll take a look at that, too.
Okay.
Gerard, are you back yet?
Yep.
You want to take the video?
Okay. So
Thanks.
That's Asulu. Looks like Montana. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
And by the way, if anybody wants to get into the queue, we only have a few people in the queue, star 6, to get into the queue, star 6 and a 1.
Go ahead, Asulu. You've been unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yes. Good evening.
Good evening.
I have a question on the petition that we sent in to Joyner. With your case, I didn't know if that was it. Is there anything else I need to do after that?
No, I don't believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking to unmute. Yeah, once you send your joinder in, then you'll be contacted by Jim, and he'll go through things with you on what might be required. It starts with first filling out the form. And then the joinder is created by us, okay, and sent to you for the purpose of going and getting notarized and then mailing it in. And that really, that joinder, okay, is really the authority to move your case. I mean, we can't move your case without you giving us that authority, and we want that in affidavit form. But then there's some other papers that will go back and forth. Jim creates most of the papers. You know, they're all uniform, depending on what it is. It could be a non-judicial foreclosure case, so we have a uniform paper for that. It could be a traffic problem, or it could be a situation with a habeas corpus or CPS or APS problem. So all of that, you know, we've got all the papers written up in order to do an amicus curiae into your case, and then if satisfaction of justice is not received through that process, then that's when the case would be moved.
Okay. So I just need to just watch for what they sent me then.
Correct.
Okay.
And we did just recently have a successful habeas corpus. We just put out another habeas corpus over the weekend, which should be applied today. They should be receiving it today. You know, we are getting some success. But most of our cases, you know, we're not getting success in. They're ignoring us. But I think hopefully maybe the times they are changing. Nevertheless, on the long run, we believe we will get success on all these cases. Because until we can take down a deep state and people take authority in the courts, we're going to continue to have courts that are just unjust.
I believe in that. I'm praying for all of you, and thank you for your tireless dedication to bring our nation back. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the call. Gerard?
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Dex, Dan from Carolina. Go ahead. You're unmuted.
Ladies and gentlemen, I must give a little account of myself. Unbeknowing to probably some of you, I have been in and out of the hospital, unfortunately, but I think that I'm fairly reasonably recovering. And during the last 2 months, I've had something very traumatic, but in regard to my parents' estate, and you guys have heard a lot about the foul play and all of that. We're not going to go in 49 yards this way and 50 the other way and 100,000 somewhere else. But I will tell you what I am alluding to is apparently the best we can tie this down, that there was a breaking and entering into the condo that I have been keeping an adult cousin of mine. He's a doctor, by the way, for whatever it's worth. And grand theft of a lot of our very important legal documents that will shed 30, 40, 50 years enlightenment and speed up the process and bring justice hurriedly. A lot of these particular documents have been compromised and stolen, along with not only the Stanlin estate documents, my personal documents of investments, which in my library, you would believe, is sizable, but that is still not the big tire kicker. I had a attache case, I guess that's the correct word, folks, and it was orange and yellow in color, and I had about 10, no more than about 12 inventions written up, serious, serious inventions, and of high intellectual capacities. I sound like a salesman on this, but yeah. I'll assure you that's the way it would be labeled on some of which, because they were not all mechanical renditions of devices and pictures and drawings by me personally, the inventor. However, I have ample enough proof, and just exactly Friday, I went to my notary that's at my bank, and I won't give the name of the bank, but anyway, they have been for a series of years notarizing my documents having to do with inventions. As it turns out, our estate attorney can validate just one particular item I'll just mention. Sigma funds and Sigma growth funds at the tune of about $20,000 that I had clear multiple copies at the time of my father's death. They've been stolen, and plus some other very serious documents having to do with the person and his family's, the person that owned the condo, his father, was my brother, my father's brother. I'll get it right in a minute, maybe. And so there could be some inside situations there why I was subjected to technically being thrown out of the condo by not by my cousin. As at the time, he was in a hospital with a serious operation that occurred October the 27th, not to be lengthy with this, and of this year. And, of course, at the Sunday evening of that last few days in that month, to my surprise, I could not use my key and get back into that condo. Now, my cousin knew that I was in Shalhoub, and a lot of these Brent Winters for sure knows a particular individual by the name of Russ family that I was working on their estate. Well, my cousin knew exactly where I were. Nevertheless, my cousin is contending that while he was aware as to maybe his daughter possibly removing my documents and without a, because I've been in that condo for at least three solid years, without an eviction notice or some reasoning, you just cannot do what happened to Dan Stanley. And the estate documents, technically, that are needed so validly in final note here to prove the estate, we still have ample of another documents to prove those documents, even though they've not quite gotten to court. And we can do that through our attorney, because he can vouch that those Sigma funds and so forth. I won't go in all the financials. There's more than just Sigma funds, financials that are at foul play. With that said, I'm in a kind of a dilemma with that, and there's a case already started, and it started with the North Myrtle Beach Police, County Police, and they have started on the wrong foot. And they're trying almost to put me to prove that by mail or something, showing the condo, and I won't quote this on this conference and address, to prove that, yes, that I have been a constant, and, yes, this is my address for the last 3 years. Well, I've got a statement in the last few days of the registered, manager knows me personally, knew that I was in this particular condo. She made a statement that, in fact, nobody to her knowledge and has been receiving any mail in this particular resort area. I'm going to call it a subdivision, and where these condos are and where I was housed. And particularly, she made a particular statement, the manager, over these condos, and she was over the Homeowners Association in closing, that in fact the particular unit that the officers came out was documented. I'm hearing somebody in the background. Does someone need to ask something?
Well, I was looking on the map and I see it was this tobacco farm about 20 acres in the business.
No, that's someone's mic open. We'll try to get that fixed.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, I was trying to be as brief because most of you folks know me very well. And I can sure tell you before New Year's and after on New Year's Day, I was in surgery. And so by the second day, still again, I'm not all there completely, but with Godspeed and your prayers in this dilemma, and especially to my health, which is more important, I bring this to you guys. And I sent in, I don't know, Mr. John, whether you, but I had a chance, an opportunity to give a small briefing to Mr. Jan, and I won't go any further than let you know that I put some very professional documents intended in good faith. And I believe once you, Mr. John, and Brent get to see these, now this is concerning a declaration for redress of grievances and other matters that could shoulder up to help an individual get a common law land trust. Now, you know that's been my quest for some time. Well, it just so happens a declaration of redress of grievances is right now knocking at the door because of the United States Post Office postmaster has refused to give me a simple document stating that for the last 3 years, to her knowledge, none of her carriers have ever carried, or forever, is the way the other manager puts it, made any kind of services or given any service to anybody in there in any of those units from a standpoint of U.S. mail service to that parish, that particular area. And I've got to get this straight so that the Horry County Police that started this case can get a proper accounting and put them in into a case where there can be possibly a chance of due process of law. Absent of this postmaster's document, I might could go over that and go to the supervisor of that lady. As clearly, anyone that would possibly consider going in that parish there and certain units turn over and purchase a unit, it would be very simple to go in and say, now, Miss Postmaster, do you provide mail in? If I get this unit right over here, do we get mail here or not? And it'd be something very simple as a question. It's either yes or no that they've been supplying to my physical condo, and neither my cousin nor I for 3 years have had any bit of mail. And but yet we're now having to prove otherwise to the local officer that came out. That's an unbelievable dilemma.
Okay, boy, that was convoluted there, huh? So, what's your question? You have a question?
Well, it's such that with the situation where that this officer, well, I will say this a little further. My next door neighbor in, I'm going to call it Unit 15, has seen me for 3 years, he and his wife. He was totally in agreement, realizing what had happened. And that I have I was cast out, in other words, of my own domain and a residence in that condo. And he was agreeing to fill out a document saying he knows me and has been in this condo right side of us for 3 years, and he nor his wife receives any mail. And he was going to do this when he consulted his so-called attorney, I guess, in the state of South Carolina. And that attorney told him to not to be aware that he's liable to have to hire an attorney to represent himself. He's liable to have to go to court, all kind of stuff. So he threw a monkey wrench into my neighbor, who, just to tell you this, for the last two hurricanes we've had, we're in Hurricane Alley there, and for the last two hurricanes, that man would call me up and his wife and ask me for updates on their condo. But yet, here, because of this attorney of theirs, has told him, in other words, technically to not turn state evidence. I think that, you didn't hear that till just then. I think that's another situation of why we need common law in this nation, because of the corrupt officials. It's like Johnny Cochran says, who's going to police the police? Now, I know there's some other considerations as to why Johnny Cochran said that, but you got to understand, on the other side, we have some very valid police officers, and we have some that are of authority to some degree and come out and do a job according to, possibly as close as they can, the Constitution. That's what their oath of office is about. But in this case, this is, if I was to tell you that this officer interviewed, he was there for 2 to 2.5 hours while I was trying to load my car up and going 3 flights of stairs, and he was questioning, interrogating everyone, and it was like a crowd of prospects. He was seeing and hearing all what was going on from each and every one, and the others were tooting the others. You would not believe this most ridiculous officer investigation that you, and nor did we ever go inside the condo, even though I got oodles of notes of exactly where tremendous documents and information was located, right on a bed in plain view. It's called plain doctrine, plain view doctrine site, in essence. Clearly was stolen, and so this estate has been through it.
Yeah, well, that sounds very convoluted. And look, it's due process that's lacking. And if you could get due process, you could subpoena some of that stuff. And even the neighbor that doesn't want to come in because he's worried about legal costs or something, he could be subpoenaed in, you know. So I don't know. You got a lot of stuff going on there, but it sounds like the same stuff that all our cases go through, where you're just not getting the due process that's due you.
Well, I will tell you in closing that the officer interviewed my cousin, who's the doctor and the owner of the unit, who has not signed any documents and told him so, of any eviction as far, and even in while my cousin was in the hospital, he signed no documents for Marcus Daniel Stanlin, which is me, his cousin, to visit him, and I visited him many times from October the 27th, but I only discovered on about Sunday night, about the 30th of October, I think that's the correct date. And when I could not, my key would not fit, and I could not get it. So I've been out of that condo ever since that moment. But I knew at that moment that someone had stolen my documents out of that condo. I already could tell by my bedroom and everything else, and even my medications and stuff. So I will tell you this. I meant to say I was closing just a second ago, and that is this. My cousin was asked point blank, how long has Mr. Stanlin, your cousin here, they call me Dan, how long has Mr. Stanlin here been living in this condo? I didn't even have to answer up. My cousin was asked the question, and it was 3 years, he said, approximately 3 years or more. Well, that officer went in and told him, he said, did you know that about 8 days is all it will naturally take for anyone to establish a domain or a domicile or a residency? And so he went from there and got squalled completely into ever land. And when he asked me, this officer, did I have any mail showing where the eye had been in that condo, and I explained to him through the Hilton, and it done no good, that there was no mail provided to any of us, including my cousin. I call him Sandy, and I'm closing right here, for 3 years whatsoever, or anybody else in that around in that parish in there, for the units from AA to EE, period. No question about it. There is no mail service whatsoever. And so I don't know what I'm going to do with this post office as how to compel them to simply give me a document, and upon that, that's presented. And I've asked them to direct the document to the attention of the Horry County Police Department, North Precinct. And this person is telling me all something about going to hire some attorney, and she wasn't going to do that, and all kind of mess. And I said, you know, lady, do you know whether your officers are serving in mail out here in any of these routes? I said, do you know whether there's officers, I mean, mail carrier servicing the exact address that I'm complaining about here? And I said, you should know, and if you don't, you're a dereliction of duty, and on the other side of the nickel, you're violent. I went three different times, and that woman made me stand with surgery and being my body in trauma on my feet in North Myrtle Beach at the post office for somewhere in the neighborhood of an hour and a half to an hour and 45 minutes at least. And she knew full well that I was out there to get information, and she avoided me. And then when I did get face-to-face with her on a couple occasions, because I went there three or four times, and so I'm just really lost with this, and that's why that is part of my question. Why would anyone be subjected to not under the Freedom of Information Act that I told her that she was violating to not respond to me as to whether there has been any mail service by her carriers for whatever, and the physical address of where I was located. And she had all that information, and she seen the officer report starting to be initiated and everything. So I'm out of dilemma here.
Yeah, it sounds like you got your work cut out for you, you know. I don't know what to tell you there as far as, you know, what you could do is, to, you know, to document that, you know. I mean, if you send notice, you know, that and have it registered, and as far as, you know, your notice, you need to... You need to put in for some improper service. In other words, you weren't noticed. Let them show where you were noticed. You know, if you've actually been served anything, then there should be some sort of a record of that. And that's one of the big ones that, you know, we get against us all the time when we're going for it. They always claim that they had improper service. So you should do the same. I don't know. You know, it's a little bit long of a convoluted case for me to answer all that stuff now. But, you know, there's a couple things you should probably be doing. And I don't know exactly, you know, who you're going to talk to that you got to get somebody to pull on the carpet there.
We got to figure out a simplicity of the whole thing. You know, basically most of the things that we deal with get really down to the simplicity of the problem. Usually it's a due process or a jurisdictional problem. They don't have jurisdiction. And so on. So that's what has to be established there to really do anything. But with that, we really need to move on because we have people in the queue.
Yeah.
And
okay, Dan. You know, all you got.
Well, I have been told to go there and put a mail to that address, and put and have several of my friends do the same thing with the return address of there. And that return address would show to these officers, several of my friends have considered this, and with the absence of no one coming in there to my aid to say and stand up and turn state evidence. I'm going through this hospital stuff, and this ain't been easy. Okay. Anyway, thank you very much, guys. I wanted to bring you to that understanding, and I am convinced that when you do know that I have done over the last 2 months insurmountable of key notes of evidences that I put together and with witnesses as to what was in that condo concerning those estate documents that didn't technically, even though they were in my care, I'm the trustee, but technically those have been stolen from the court, and justice will not prevail because of these hoodlums unless we get a case where they're arrested and indicted or whatever and put through a tribunal.
Yeah, well, that's what it's about. That's why we need that, you know, those grand juries to take care of stuff like this for the people.
Well, okay. I'm not sure we're quite to the grand jury yet with, you know, with the common law. But I hope that, Mr. John, I hope in closing on the other note that you will, and Mr. Brent Allen Winters and Gerard will see what I've seen in there professionally as to contribute to the National Liberty Alliance. And it did start out.
All right, well, we'll take a look at it. You send it to Jan?
Oh, yeah, Jan's got it today.
How long is it? It's not too long, is it?
Oh, no, sir, it is not. Matter of fact, the first part is all typed, and it even, oh, it's very professionally done, and it's
all
even got
I'll take
four
a look
cases
at that
and all
and
that.
I'll take
okay,
a look
buddy.
At that and see if we can figure anything
Thank
out.
Thank you guys for your time. We do have other people in the queue.
All right.
Thanks,
Thank
Dan.
You.
Yep.
Thanks, Gerard. That was very, I appreciate your comments.
Okay. Very good. Have a good night. Thank you.
Thank you. You made it. Thanks, sir.
Yep. Okay. We got Robert from, looks like Michigan. You've been unmuted. Are you there? Robert from Michigan, 313. I hear something in the background, so I must have walked away from the mic.
I woke up this morning.
Hello, Robert. Morning. Robert from Michigan.
It was 7:20.
No. All right, I'm going to go to Calvin because I think Robert's off the mic. Okay, Calvin from South Carolina, yes. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask y'all a question. Do y'all help with civil cases?
With civil cases?
Yes.
Well,
not really. What kind of a civil case?
I'm getting ready to go out. I'm getting ready to sue government official and all like that because in the town.
Yeah, no, we really, you know, we're limited to what we could do for numerous reasons. Funding is one, manpower is another, so we're limited to only things that really to help people that are really in trouble, like non-judicial foreclosures. They've lost, maybe CPS taking people's children, or an IRS assault, those kind of things. But no, other than that. But you can learn how to handle these things yourself by studying the website, taking our courses. We have some information on how to write papers on our website. You know, we have an anatomy of a court case. You can find that on our website. And we do have some forms and papers that you can use for certain purposes in court, and tell you how to collect and how to, you know, file a notice of, you know, a default, an affidavit of default, and you know, all those things you can learn, and how things work. So if you don't know how things work, you know, take our courses and start looking into the other things we provide on our website.
Yeah, I am a member. That's one reason why I became a member, and I started paying my dues too every month because where we live, we've been done so bad to that one official. She's part of the courts over in our capital, Columbia. She said, the way we've been done, she said she can't afford to live that way. She said she got to try to do something because we've been done so bad to that. It's a shame to say how the government, like the man said earlier, who going to police the police. Because we have been done so bad and our civil rights have been thrown out the window. So that's one of the reasons why I joined the national level of the Alliance, because I know if I've been done this way, how many more going to be done after me? How many more have been done before me? So I'm trying to step up my act and try to help myself. And in turn, I'm going to turn around and help others who that I know that going to be going through this. Because if they can get by this with me and my wife, how many more they going to try to get by this with? Because we even went to one of the government official and show him all the evidence we had and ask him what can we be done about it. He said nothing. And I'm saying, how can that be so? So that's what got me pushing more further right now, to get deeply involved with every little asset that I can and learn as much as I can and go after these people, because these people need to be dealt with. I mean, they need to be dealt with daily, because they've been put all our finances. They didn't run our life, really. They really have. And
well, one of the things you're going to find out by trying to sue these people is you're not going to get nowhere. You're not going to get justice. That's unfortunate, because that's just the way it is. They maintain the status quo in the courts. They do not apply the Constitution. They don't care about the people. They don't care who gets injured. They have no compassion, no empathy for people. In my opinion, federal judges and state judges, majority of them are just evil people. And the only way we're going to fix this problem is to accomplish the goals of National Liberty Alliance, take back control of our courts of law, take back controls of our political process, and get the militia going up and going. And then between those three things, we will have government by consent. We'll get rid of the politicking. We'll get rid of all of these evil judges. We can fix anything in government. We have all the tools, but we don't have the power and the authority because we don't step up to learn it and take it. We need to do that now. People need to get connected now and do it.
Even in his civil case, that's one reason why I joined,
because I said I want to get with me. And within the police, how do I find out who is a committee on the committee in my county?
Well, look, the first thing to do is start reading the pages, filing and getting educated. We're organizing now, and at some point in time, you will be contacted by someone who takes up the position of organizing the county. Once we get about 6 or 7 people in the county, we would figure we'd have someone to organize it and start working and calling everyone together and start meeting and working out relationships with the sheriffs and so on. But again, we don't want to jump too quickly, but we do want to move as fast as we can. But we have to move with knowledge and education. We don't want to just jump into the frying pan and get burnt, you know.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, it begins with signing up, it begins with educating, and it begins with eventually people will step up, someone will step up in the county, maybe you'll be the person who step up in the county and say, oh, we got 6 people in my county right now, or we got 20 people in my county, it's time to go, let's get a meeting going, let's try to organize. And then again, we're going to lay out what people need to do and how to do it. All that is being put together as we speak, but now is the time of educating and organizing. Educate, organize, go forward.
Yeah, and he could learn how to move his case to the federal court for cause, so he could establish a record once he learns what's going on. You know, I mean, as far as, because like you said, you're not going to get justice in their court. So at least if he takes the case and moves it into the federal court for cause, because they're going to violate him, they're going to violate his due process. So, you know, that's a record in the court that you're making a record of, so that when things do straighten out, we get some good judges, you'll have real, your case will already be sitting there. It'll be a record in the court. And I think that's important. You know, and people that do that are the ones that are gonna get their due process first, because they're there first. They have to take care of them. That's, at least that's the way I see it. So,
okay.
All right?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we got Jim from New York. Jim, are you there? Is that Bagel Beans, Jim, from New York? Must have put him to sleep. Going once, twice. We only got a few minutes, so Jim, if you want to say something, get back in the queue. I'm going to go ahead and open up Tamara from Florida. We only got a couple people. We only got a couple minutes, so if you get back on, jump in the queue and I'll pick you out. Okay.
Hello.
Hey, there you go. Okay. What's going on, Jim?
Here I am. I thought I was unmuted, and I guess I wasn't. All right. So I got a question on one of these. I was just dealing with it right now. So I had a woman did an amicus curiae. It's more like for John, really. And she got kicked out of her house. She was in the process of doing all of this. And she was taking care of an elderly gentleman, and she'd known him for years. And she didn't have any place to go, so he said, you can stay here because you're going to be taking care of me anyway. So she moved in there, and then with about a month and a half later, they got married. And then 2 weeks after that, he passed away.
Oh, boy.
So now she's moving to federal court. She said, what a life. I never thought that would happen. So anyway, just beyond that, yeah, prayers for her. But so the question is, now when she moves to federal court, does she change her name on the new document? Does she use her new married name on the moving to federal court?
Well, I think she could include her maiden name and her married name. That's, you know, it's all her name. So if it was me, I'd list it both. You know what I'm saying?
That's what I'm trying to find out. Because
yeah, I think she can list both names because, you know, her status has changed or whatever. But I would not drop my maiden name because that could make confusion. So I think she should put it in with her maiden name and her new married name. I mean, I see people who have five names,
yeah,
one right after.
Yeah, like a hyphenated name or something.
Exactly. I think that's the safest way because what she's doing is she's preserving, you know, her spot, her name, and then she's also acknowledging her married. You know, she's got the documentation if there's any questions, you know, as far as it goes. But that way there, it's up front. I think she should, you know, do both. I mean, that's my advice. I mean, I'm not a lawyer or anything, but I think she could do that if she wants.
I think that's full disclosure. That's all that's really needed. But I just
need to get
the information. I don't want to send it out and have it, you know, have it kicked back, you know. All right. That's about it.
Yeah, I don't know what else you would do. I mean, like you said, full disclosure. So I think she should just go ahead and use her name and hyphenate the new name, the married name. You know, I don't know if she, you know, if it's even worth, you know, she could put a writer in there or some kind of statement that she's been married in the course of the case. So now, you know, you know how you change a case for here and after, I will be known as Mrs. So-and-so. You know what I mean? I think she could do that too, you know?
Okay.
Okay.
All right. That's good enough.
Okay. I'm going to go on to Tara here. We got a few minutes left, so go ahead, Tara Nova.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I'm on my computer here. I have a question about arbitration awards.
What was that? I didn't hear that. What kind of an award?
Arbitration.
Oh, arbitration. Okay.
Yeah, I received an arbitration award in a foreclosure case as a result of them defaulting on the contract and command for the questions that I asked them.
Are you looking for execution?
Yeah, I'm at that point where I'm sending them invoices now, and they're trying to throw it out in court.
Throw what out in court? Whoa. Throw what out in court?
The arbitration award.
Oh, no. Arbitration is final.
Right, but they put a motion in front
of the court. Look it. Go lay your position out on paper. Write it up as best you can. Go down to your court and look to talk to one of the judges down there and ask him to help you. What other than this paper that you have, tell him, what else do I need to do? Is there a form or what can I do because I want to execute this with the sheriff? And he'll tell you what to do. He may just take, scratch a few things on it, put a stamp and seal, sign it, and take it, go see the sheriff. He may make it that simple. But you have to be very specific. And the referral to the arbitration, and you need to be very specific on what the conclusion of an arbitration. You got a decision from the arbitrator, so you'll have that in writing, and then you lay out the very specifics of what you were expecting, which was, we look at the two and call the wherefore clause, which is very specifically on what the execution needs to be. So you have to define that very clearly, and then go see a judge. I've done that before.
Oh, which court should I go to?
You go to the state court within your county.
What about if the defendant is in California? Does that matter?
Well, no, because once you get the papers signed up and everything, you should be able to get a hold of the sheriff in California within his county and execute it. But at that point, you can talk with the sheriff, or you can even ask the judge about that kind of a situation. But it'll probably be a sheriff-to-sheriff thing, maybe.
Right, because I want to liquidate their assets. But what happens when I put the arbitration award on a UCC-1?
You keep coming in and out. You're going to have to get closer to your phone or your mic or whatever.
Yeah, sounds like you got a bad connection or something.
Oh, well, it's a computer.
Oh. Yeah, if the mic is on your monitor and you move to right to left, your voice comes in and out because it's not, you got to be talking straight to the mic. Always get a headset, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm doing the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, if you can hear me, I just wanted to say that I put it on a UCC-1, and they made a motion to the judge to terminate the UCC-1.
What are you using the UCC-1 for?
To put my arbitration award as a collateral.
Well, I don't know anything about that. Again, collateral for what?
In other words, it's an asset that I'm claiming.
And you're claiming it through the commercial process? I don't know why you would be going through that. If you want an arbitration is final. Take your papers. The arbitrator wrote a written decision on that, and then you take a paper and you lay out the details of exactly what's owed to you or whatever it is that you're looking to retrieve back. Go down and talk to the judge. He'll assist you from there. He'll probably send you. I would go see the judge. I went straight down and I wanted to talk to the judge, and the judge helped me out. But I had my paperwork pretty well filled out at that point. He really just signed it up and said go see the sheriff with it. And I went and saw the sheriff, gave it to him, and he collected. So he may, if you need paper help or something, he may refer you over to the clerk to assist you, then come back to him for signature.
Okay, because...
But don't go through the other thing. That's why you're running into trouble. And you're going to get, look at it. If they can get some judge to do something stupid, then you're going to be stuck with nothing again, and you're going to have to go through the whole process again. So, but...
Right. Well, I just want to say that, Justice Kavanaugh, he came out recently and said that you do not need to get a confirmation of your arbitration award in the lower court. So a lot of people were going and trying to get confirmation, and they weren't getting anywhere.
I don't even understand what they mean by that, to be honest with you. Look it, take your paper, go get an execution.
Right.
Just go get an execution. Write down very specifically on what, how and what they owe, And it should kind of balance off with the decision. You bring your decision with you from the arbitrator. It's a written decision. And you take it to the judge, and the judge will sign it and seal it and say, have a good day. And you go down and see the sheriff.
Okay, well, the last judge did not want anything. I mean, she totally threw it out.
Well, I don't know what judge. What kind of a judge are you talking about? Who is this judge? A state judge, federal judge, city judge, town judge, village judge?
Oh no, bankruptcy judge.
Oh, well, what does that have to do with anything? Did the people file for bankruptcy, and you're trying to collect off of that?
Well, I was going to take the award and pay off my house with it.
You're going on a road of insanity. You know, I know people are teaching those things. I've looked into it, and I'm far away from that. You can get yourself in trouble with that, too, so you better be careful. I've seen people go to jail playing the game with that stuff, with the commercial code. But look it. Just go collect and then use it to pay off. Go collect it. It's a simple problem. I'm telling you, it's so simple. I could, you know, it just moves right through. Once you go to that sheriff, he goes out. I'll tell you, within 48, 72 hours, he's going out, and he's going to collect.
Right. He'll take whatever he has to take, right?
He's going to take anything. And you can help him find things, and there's ways to do that, but I don't have time to get into that. So.
Okay, yeah, because this is a big bank, and they have...
It's a very simple process. I've repeated it about two or three times, so if you're still not sure, download the MP3 of this conversation and listen through it again. Because really what I'm saying is really very simple. It's a very, very simple process. And there are people who will help you. But you're not going to get any assistance in a bankruptcy court. You don't want to turn it into commercial type things. That's craziness. Believe me when I tell you that. These are people, and some of them get success this way, but I doubt much of them get success. And some people go to jail because depending on how they're trying to, you know, execute these commercial things. So, look, you got a rock solid thing. You got arbitration. It's done. Case over. Finished. Done.
Right.
Move on. Go get it.
Okay. Well, I'll be glad to visit the sheriff. Thank you, John.
That's simple. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Good night.
Night.
Gerard, you muted?
I thought I was just hard of hearing.
Nope, it looks like he's muted.
Not on mine. This is headset muted.
Hi, this is Tamara in Florida. I was curious, can you tell me where exactly this place is that everyone is meeting to work on the indictment?
Right here.
Where is here? Is there?
Well, on the same number that you're called in on right now.
So we read all the documents and then call in and we all work together to get an indictment?
Yeah, he sent out a letter earlier today.
Yes, you got that letter?
Yeah, go study that page. There's several links on that page. Study that and be here at 9 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday. Does that make sense?
All right.
Yeah, it's really very, very simple. Read the page and read the information on the page and you can come and cast your decision.
All right, thank you.
It's going to be very quick. You know, whenever we do these things, it's very quick because everybody reviews all of the evidence, you know, between now and the time we're going to meet. And we like as much participation as possible. So anybody hearing this, they should come.
I have a situation where somebody's in jail and I'm working on getting the amicus curiae done. After that's filed, should I file a writ of habeas corpus?
I don't know. Why would you file a habeas corpus? Is someone in jail or someone being
Yeah,
helped?
Someone's in jail and their due process rights were violated.
Okay, but why are you doing an amicus curiae when you could do what are they in jail for? Did they get their due process?
No due process.
Okay,
no,
what are they in jail for?
It was a dispute between, like a domestic dispute between a mom and a son.
Okay.
And it was 3 years ago almost.
All right, well, look it. Do a habeas corpus.
Okay.
That's the first place to go. Then if that doesn't work, you know, we can move over to moving it for cause, you know.
Got you. Okay, sounds good. Thank you, John.
All righty.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you. Go ahead.
Yes. I listened a couple of weeks ago, and a guy brought up the removal from civil court to federal court, and the diversity of citizenship. Okay, different states, different countries, but the $75,000. Things got me puzzled. Isn't that usurping the Seventh Amendment of the controversy of $20 or more? And how did they get around that? I mean, who came up with that $75,000? And I thought the Seventh Amendment covered that. So I'm curious about that. And then I hear
I'm missing you on that. What are you talking about? Someone's telling you it has to be $75,000 to get a court of record?
The 28 U.S.C. 1441B.
Yeah, well, look, all of that is garbage. It doesn't mean anything to we the people. Those are rules for equity. It's not rules for law. And they are applying the rules of equity to rules of law. They're applying rules of insanity, okay, is what they're really applying to rules of equity and law. They've combined equity and law together under Rule 2, and thereby they subverted the Constitution. They abrogated the common law. They've destroyed the Constitution, and they pay no attention to it. That's why we're getting all this craziness in the courts. That's why they're getting away with it. But they shouldn't, because that's treason. There's nothing else to talk about. There's no way they can defend against that treason, number one. And it's up to the United States Supreme Court to fix that problem through writs of mandamus. And if that doesn't go by, then they need to start to take these judges out. And Congress, unfortunately, are a bunch of morons, and they're lost in their own game, and all this craziness going there. They're not even capable of doing their own job anymore, because those are the people that should be removing them from office. And since they don't remove them from office, and the United States Supreme Court won't do their job, we are indicting. And as we go through the list, we're gonna have a lot of more federal judges going onto that list. And we're gonna file it with the Justice Department, and file it with the United States Supreme Court, and file it up in our court of record up in the Northern District, and we're just gonna move forward. And at one point in time, these people need to be arrested and go to jail, because the people spoke. We the people are the courts of law. We run our own courts. It's not up to these bureaucrats that think that they have total control over courts of law. No, they're in courts of equity. Stay out of the court of law. Give us just an administrator. It's called the magistrate, and all they do is do the will of the tribunal, sign the papers, put the seal on it, send it out for execution. Job done.
Right. Well, I appreciate good answer. And that rule, too, it seems like it covers a lot of things when you usurp the Constitution, right? And my next question is pretty much to move. I hear so many people on the Internet trying to help people. And one thing I always talk about is a judge that's acting ministerial, administrative, he loses immunity. But I never hear anybody quote a case where a judge has been punished for acting in the administrative role and out of immunity and was brought to answer about it. But here again,
because they protect their own. You know, unfortunate, and it's true, though, that even the police department, they protect their own. You know, whatever you go into, people are protecting their own, and the judicial department is no different. And you see, that's why, we the people deserve everything we get. All this problem is because we're too lazy to educate ourselves and take control. We are trying to teach people how to do that. I go and talk to thousands of people. I go on radio programs. I go different places. We talk to people. And, you know, we get a couple people here and a couple people there. You know, everybody, we got a lot of patriots, okay, that the quote-unquote active patriots. And at the end of the day, they don't step up and do the right thing. They don't sign up. They don't become the militia. They don't become the committeemen. They don't take up these jobs. You know, if we lose this nation, we lose liberty. Trump can't save this nation. He can bring us to a certain point to save this nation. That's true. But it's up to the people to take control and maintain that. Otherwise, it will only going to be back to where we were, and we'll go very quickly back to where we were. I'm telling you, we'll do it in one generation if we don't fix this problem now. People need to get up and take control of this on a grassroots level. Just get educated and do it. And if we don't do it, we deserve everything we get.
I appreciate everything you said tonight. I agree with
you. I just hope the Lord takes me before we get everything we deserve.
Right. I agree with you, no doubt. I hear you, man. I'm telling you, the founding father was here. I tell everybody we'd be at a civil war right now, man.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Yeah. Okay. Good night. All the best to everybody. And then, you know, keep up the fight, everybody.
Okay. Godspeed. All right. With that, we're going to shut down. Appreciate everyone for coming. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And, you know, there's still a couple people in the queue. Maybe you can get in early next week and get into the queue right away. But, okay, get active, everybody. Get up there. Get reading. We're considering an indictment on Thursday. Get up there, go to nationallibertyalliance.org, and go underneath the grand jury, highlight the grand jury, come down two down, and it's the indictment consideration. Click on that, absorb that information. It'll take every bit of 10 or 15 minutes to read through all this stuff, and then be there on Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here in this room, for the consideration of an indictment on a governor down in Virginia. And and also, you know, register for the militia. Register to become a committeeman. Let's start, get educated. Get into the course. Take the government by consent course. We're having a militia course. It'll be up in the next 48 hours, most likely. So take that course, too. We have a civics course, extremely important. How did we get to where we're at? You know, if we don't look and understand history and remember history, we are doomed to repeat it. Let's fix the problem and end it. Good night, everybody. Thanks for coming.